Coming up on Boston Public Radio, Boston 2024 is steamrolling along. Good polls, no opposition from the political elite. While the mayor opposes a popular vote on the Olympics coming to town, we'll ask you if the public should have the final say. Then the Globe's Alex Beam on naysaying, and he would know. And something you may never have heard of, manslamming. Then at noon, jury selection proceeds in the Tsarnaev trial. We'll ask you the question the judge in the case must determine the answer to. Could you be a fair and impartial juror?
Callie Crossley on the Oh So White Oscar nominations, a live performance in studio by Dwight Richer of the Dwight Richer Band, which is in town this weekend. Emily Rooney with her famous list and her rants about the Tsarnaev trial, and getting a head start on National Cheese Lovers Day. Our Friday news quiz will feature two local cheesemakers. All that coming up on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
From a transmitter atop Great Blue Hill, this is WGBH, live, local talk, Boston Public Radio.
He's Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Good morning, Jim.
We're a little discombobulated. We're just hoping just the listeners do not pick up on that particular fact.
I'm discombobulated. Quite a bit, actually.
Okay, so according to a new poll, this is in the Boston Globe this morning, a piece written by Shirley Young, the Boston Olympic bid gets a thumbs up from 55% of Massachusetts residents, 40% disapprove, 5 are undecided. That might sound like good news for Olympics 2024 enthusiasts, but not when you compare it to other cities, which Shirley does. According to the International Olympic Committee, local support for the Games was 91% in Madrid, 85% in Paris, 77% in Moscow when they were bidding in 2012. So our question to you is quite simple. Should the public have the final say on this question? The number is 877-301-8970. Would you like Boston Olympics 2024, the committee's called Boston 2024, essentially to become a ballot issue, just like the casino? The final word on casinos was an effort to repeal it, obviously, which failed on the ballot. Our number is 877-301-8970.
Are you asking me that question, Jim?
Well, you should feel free to answer, Margaret.
I would say yes.
Let the voters decide.
I would like to have something to say about this. Yes, I would. I love Scott Lehigh's column today talking about the kings and queens and the dukes and duchesses are making the decisions at the highest level, and the little serfs, that's the rest of us, are just told to shut up and get with the program. I mean, that's basically it. And, you know, Aaron Smith had a great piece in the Herald today talking about how the Olympic Committee, the International Olympic Committee, does not like it when there's a lot of opposition to the Olympics coming there in these individual cities, and that they're going to be doing polls themselves. And this may, if we are the ones that are most opposed, I don't know how they feel in the other cities that may be competing, the Parises, the Berlins, et cetera, but that could be a point against us in the final decision.
Well, by the way, Andrew Zimbalist, you know, who's been all over the place, including with us, he's a Smith economist who opposes this. I interviewed him on TV right before the USOC made their decision, and he thought the fact that there was a lot of opposition, even though there hadn't been a poll done since June, might cause the USOC to end up not picking Boston. By the way, you know, two public officials who matter quite a bit. Marty Walsh has said, he's the mayor, obviously, has said quite clearly there should not be a vote. Charlie Baker was with us yesterday on Ask the Governor, his first of his monthly appearances. Somebody called in and asked the governor whether he'd support a ballot referendum on the Boston 2024 Olympics. Again, letting the voters decide. Here's what the new governor had to say yesterday.
I'm a big believer in the referendum process. I always have been. And if people want to collect the signatures and do the work associated with putting a referendum on the ballot, either on a statewide basis or a citywide basis, they are free to do so. I mean, we've got the process in place, and people can choose to take it.
And by the way, Scott Lehigh in his column talks about a non-binding citywide vote. I think there should be a binding vote. And by the way, while it's in Boston, obviously the implications could be statewide. And let me tell you why I think it's a good idea, and it shouldn't just be opponents. Joanna Rice writes a great piece today, which I hadn't even thought about street protests, a la yesterday.
Exactly.
Coming up to the Olympics. Now, if the proponents of the Olympics said the following to the protesters, you know what? If you're troubled about this, we'll let you decide. You make a commitment to us. You won't disrupt. we will make a commitment, which obviously they have to do legally, or maybe even if it's advisory, we'll be bound by it. We'll be bound by a statewide vote, again, in return for which you don't protest. So I would argue that both sides should embrace this thing.
And she also points out that there's two different organized groups so far, anyway, that are against the Olympics. There's no Boston Olympics, and that's we've had some of those guys on there. Chris Dempsey, and he's running the group. He used to run the MBTA's Open Data Initiative. I'm not sure what that is, but anyway, he ran it. There's this other group, No Boston 2024, and they are much more aligned with the kind of protesting that went on yesterday on the Southeast Expressway, coming into work and, you know, northbound and southbound and so forth. So the question to people is, you know, are you ready if these groups get bigger for this kind of nonstop protest? Here's my favorite quote of the day from the protesters that were there yesterday talking about their halting traffic as people were coming into work in the morning. Protesters defended their action blocking the Route 93 north and south as a necessary call for change. Quote, disruptions wake people up a little bit from their privilege and insulation, said Shannon Larry, a spokesman for the Milton protest. And I couldn't help but think, if all those workers that were driving in, maybe their minimum wage jobs.
You know those privileged workers? What, are you changing your position on this?
I feel as though that they're in privileged and insulated situations. No, I'm all in favor of people protesting. These people, there was something, I must admit, a little bit annoying about this particular group.
Okay, let's say, by the way, when Kelly Crossley comes in, we're going to discuss the protest on 93 with her. And when Emily Rooney comes in, can't wait for that, we're going to be discussing the protest with her. Now we're discussing whether or not there should be a vote on whether the Olympics should come to Boston and to Massachusetts. And by the way, we rarely would ask you to do this, but I think it's important you say to us whether, as of now, when you tell us whether you think there should be a vote, whether you're for or against the Olympics coming today. Because my assumption is everybody who's against the Olympics coming is going to say, of course, there should be a statewide initiative. And my guess is, I could be wrong, that most people who favor it are probably saying no, because obviously they're in a role, as you said, Scott Lehigh said, the kings and queens. I mean, the power brokers. Who wrote the piece today in the Globe? Who wrote the piece? Oh, Jim O'Sullivan wrote the piece. Why is there no political opposition? And you know,
that's a great graphic.
It is really
of all the politicians waving the Olympic torches and flags.
Are you not surprised?
Olympic symbols. Well, I think one of the very interesting pieces. There's so many good stories about the Olympics in the papers today. You know, that Menino had been a little lukewarm previously. The previous mayor of Boston, obviously Tom Menino, about the Olympics. I guess he got a little less lukewarm as he got closer to the end of his life, as it turns out. But that a lot of the power brokers were kind of playing a wait-and-see game because Menino was not that keen on it. And this piece does point out that everybody seems to be lined up behind John Fish from Suffolk Construction, who has recused himself from doing any business in the Olympics. But they got Deval Patrick, House Speaker Robert DeLeo, the outgoing Attorney General Martha Coakley, Marty Walsh, the mayor of Boston, Stanley Rosenberg, the new Senate president, and Charlie Baker, that seem to be okay with this.
So and the only person on the other side is Marjorie Egan. There's a great line in that story. Jim O'Sullivan, who's a great writer, wrote that piece in the Boston Globe. Essentially, today, the Globe is the Boston Olympics Globe. It's everywhere. Listen to this great line. He says, it's an unusual dynamic in a civic ecosystem that cherishes its seemingly divine right to turn even the most picayune policy question into a pitch battle. That is such a perfect description of us in Massachusetts. 877-301-8970. This is the simplest, most direct question we should ask. Should the people decide if Boston should be a candidate to get the Olympics in 2024?
It's just crazy that we have absolutely no say. I think it's not a very democratic situation, Jim.
Can I make one more argument for it?
What?
Beyond the fact that I think it would actually even help the proponents of the Olympics.
So you're for a favor of a vote, too.
Well, by the way, I'm a big direct democracy kind of guy. Well, that's what it's called. But let me tell you another reason for this is it is amazing to me that we've gotten this far and there's been no vote by anybody who we've elected to anything. City council hasn't voted. The legislature,
and they could as well,
under
obviously.
Eileen Donohue, obviously the state senator, former mayor of Lowell, who was the first person to get on this bandwagon, they put together some commission or something. But the fact that if our elected representatives haven't spoken, and there is some divide, even though by 55-40 they support it. By the way, in that same poll, by a 2-to-1 margin, they don't want any taxpayer money used. I don't know what they mean by no taxpayer money.
Well,
no federal, no state.
Let's
I don't
just
know what
say
they
right
mean.
Now. There is going to be taxpayer money. We know that already. There's going to be massive federal money. We talked about this with Juliette Kayyem. The security concerns are going to be absolutely enormous.
Yeah, but can I tell you, we tried to get the poll this morning. And the reason is, if I were asked that question, do you want taxpayer money, I wouldn't have thought of it the way you did. You thought of it as any taxpayer money. I immediately, when I read the question, and I think it was poorly framed by the pollster, thought they meant Massachusetts taxpayer money.
Well, Jim, once again, I'll use the oldest cliche in the book. I was born at night, but not last night.
You weren't?
As we all can recall, that the feds are going to pay for 90% of the big dig.
Yeah.
We know how well that worked.
How'd that go?
It did not work very well. But even if we were to get all this federal money, which I'm thinks is probably not going to happen, but it is still taxpayer dollars. So Oregon and the whole country is going to be paying for our having the Olympics here in Boston.
Who cares? I'm saying, I mean,
well, you can say who cares. I think taxpayers.
Wait, is your position? And you said this to Juliette Kayyem the other day, and I was actually stunned. Is your position that if a country gets the Olympics, that no taxpayer dollar? I don't want to see this become the big dig. Let me be clear. But your view. So should we not even be spending the transportation money we're spending to help facilitate?
You know what I would
Olympics
like to see.
What?
You know what I would like to see.
Totally privately.
I would
funded.
Like to exactly.
Okay. Well, I hear you. Let's
go to and maybe a little bit of public money.
And maybe that's
but
what the 2-to-1 vote. Margin in the poll means
and billions and
well,
billions.
I don't think anybody except the most wild supporter of this wants serious additional taxpayer money spent on this. I find that hard to believe. The problem, and we asked Charlie Baker this yesterday, I have not heard one satisfactory answer. What is the guarantee that the goodwill of Baker, Walsh and everybody else,
there is none.
And Fish, who say there'll be no additional
got
taxpayer
this
money.
Teeny weeny. When I first read about the $25 million
insurance
policy, I thought, oh, well, that's pretty good. But then Andrew Zimbalist pointed out to me, what are you talking about? That's like a drop in the bucket. They need a multi-billion-dollar insurance policy.
Let me tell you how bad it is, then we'll get to the calls. When I read that first, I guess it had happened while I was
away. Yeah, I fell for it too.
I thought the $25 million was the premium. On the policy that was billions.
No.
In fact, the premium was like $800,000 or $900,000.
I don't know what it was.
For a $25 million policy.
But we're getting railroaded. That is by.
Well, I don't know. But the answer, the solution is having a ballot campaign.
Okay.
Let the people decide.
Mary Kay from Scituate. What do you think, Mary Kay?
Hi there.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I am totally against the Olympics. And yes, I want to vote on it because I want to vote against it.
Why are you totally opposed?
I am totally opposed because there is no historical evidence that the bid given is ever going to be what is actually spent. And I do not believe that taxpayer dollars should ever be spent for a sporting event of any kind.
Well, you're pretty much where Marjorie is.
Yeah, you know what I was stunned to discover from Juliette Kayyem the other day? That the federal government pays for security for the Super Bowl.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I Mary Kay, should not the NFL...
What's that, Mary Kay?
The NFL should definitely pay
absolutely.
For it.
Absolutely.
Mary Kay, thank you. But let me tell you, there's a difference. There's a difference. And it's sort of like, Mary Kay, you have a horrible connection, so we've got to let you go. I'm sorry. But thank you for the call. I oppose, and virtually everybody opposed. Remember when I don't know if it was the Crafts, they wanted some sort of bridge or something, pedestrian walk that may have been in the state budget. There is no excuse, in my estimation, for tax dollars going to support a private enterprise. An attempt to get the Olympics is a little bit different animal. I don't want to see ballooning costs, but the notion that if we use existing transportation dollars that's in the pipeline already and don't end up hurting the Worcesters and the Springfields by focusing all the money here, the money's going to be spent anyway. Additional money is a whole other issue, and that's why I think the question was poorly framed in the poll.
Mike from Everett, what do you think, Mike?
Hi, Mike.
Hold on. Jim, I'm sorry. I definitely believe that I support the Olympics, although I believe that there should be a vote. As somebody that's been involved in two initiative ballot questions in the past 15 months.
Oh, you're the casino, Mike?
I am, and I'm the one that asked Governor Baker yesterday his opinion on the referendum.
Oh, I didn't know that was you, Mike. Former city councilor in Everett, correct?
Correct, Jim. And, you know, I seen the benefits of the initiative when we had the ballot question in Everett. Let the people make a decision whether they want to spend $5 billion of their money on the Olympics.
And by the way, for those who don't know, the pro-casino vote, the local vote in Everett was, what, 86%, Mike?
Almost 87%. And Mr. Wynch touted on that last night at the Colliers International Seminar. And Mr. Fish had spoken before that, gave a great presentation. I think the Olympics could be very successful, but let the people have a voice whether they want to make this a possibility for Boston or not. And I think Mayor Walsh's hypocrisy on this issue is very interesting, that he thinks Charlestown should vote on a privately funded development in Everett but not allow his residents to vote on us bringing the Olympics into Boston.
Mike, good call. Thank you very much. You know what I like about that call? He's for the Olympics, but he thinks there should be a vote. I mean, it is a basic democracy. Let me be clear
here. It is basic democracy.
Crazy. I want to say again, if the legislature, the people we elected, if they were voting on whether to spend any money, I might have second thoughts about this, though I'd probably still support it. But the fact that there are no public votes apparently happening is an issue.
I'll just read the lead of Scott Lehigh's column.
What do you say?
The lords and ladies here in the Kingdom of Boston desire to host the Olympic Games. That is clear. But what about the serfs? What do the little people? What do the little people think? Andrea just emailed and said, "We can't afford to fund the Olympics with the Boston school system facing a $16 million budget
deficit." By
the way,
I would say again, because they're not here, Marty Walsh would say, "I agree with you." His position continues to be that there can't be any taxpayer money used. That they can't.
Yeah.
But the issue is, what is the guarantee?
But also the argument from the no people, which is pretty compelling, we had one of them on the other day, is that all the wind is going to be taken out of the sails of the parents in the Boston school systems. I mean, the one good thing is that they do have the housing, because we really need housing in Boston, and that would be a wonderful
That's
a huge good thing, and I'll give the Olympic Committee that. But that we're not going to be talking about this. All that is going to be shoved aside in this frenzy.
I think that's a function of whether the mayor lives up to his commitment. You can't walk and chew gum at the same time. Can't talk about an Olympics and improving the city schools.
Even in our diminished state, I think a lot of pressure comes from the media. I think the media's attention is going to be elsewhere. Let's go to Steve in Providence. Hi, Steve.
Hey, Steve.
Yes. Hi, guys.
Hi.
I think it makes absolutely no difference whether there is a referendum or not, because I believe the voters in Massachusetts would approve the Olympics. And, Marjorie, I think you're missing the point in that, yes, the Olympics are an athletic competition. But the real value of it, bringing together the leaders, the future leaders from all over the world in friendly competition and gaining understanding of each other, their cultures, and I believe it will have a direct effect on understanding and reducing terrorism in the future around the world. That is the real value. And in Massachusetts, I, for one, am willing to pay an extra tax in order to promote that. And to be able to say, okay, Massachusetts, we've done our deal. I've done my bit to reduce terrorism and increase understanding around the world. That's the real value of the Olympics.
Steve, I hate to be cynical, but I don't see any evidence that there's any reduction in terrorist feelings or even a kumbaya sort of thing that came out of Russia or came out of even London. I just don't think that's...
Well, Steve might argue that in a free society, they might be. But Steve, is one of the reasons you're willing to have taxpayers fund this is because you don't live in Massachusetts?
Well, I don't live in Massachusetts, but believe me, I pay plenty of Massachusetts tax.
Okay. Hey, Steve, thank you for your call. We appreciate it. And by the way, I hope I get this right, and you'll correct me if I'm wrong. Well, Steve said there's no point to it because it's going to win anyway. I thought he was going to say no point because what's the impact? If I remember correctly, wasn't Denver's bid years ago undone? Because of a vote in the a popular vote, a ballot question, I'm pretty sure that is right. And you know, actually, we're talking about the poll. The woman who wrote about Shirley DeYoung is in the control room. We're going to ask her about it in 1 second.
Okay, we are talking about voting on the Boston Olympics 2024. Would you like to take this issue to the polls? That conversation continues on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browder. She's Marjorie. And if you're just joining us, we're talking about Boston Olympics 2024. New poll in the Globe today finds 55% of Bay State residents support it. It's not a huge majority, particularly compared, as the Globe does, to other cities who were polled on public support when they were bidding. Madrid was at 91%, Paris was in 85%, Moscow was in 77%. So our question for you is, should there be a statewide, maybe a city, a statewide or city vote on whether or not there should be an Olympics in Boston in 2024, and should it be binding on Boston 2024. You know, we had some questions about the poll.
Yes.
And the article was written by Shirley Leung, and who just shows up in the studio?
We just grabbed her off the street and brought
her in. Hey, Shirley Leung, it's great to see you.
Good to see you. I've never met you guys in person.
I know. It's absolutely wonderful. And we also think it's great that you're here, because I have been a real naysayer and a curmudgeon about these Olympics, and you have been much more willing to see what happens. So it gives a little balance in the studio as well to have Shirley here.
Hey, so Shirley, I have a question, but we're going to get back to your calls in a minute, 877-301-8970. A couple things. The second question, I mean, 55-40, and then you compared it to other cities when they were bidding in 2012, and obviously it was a much lower number. It says you're willing to have taxpayer money spent. Do you have any idea if they meant Massachusetts taxpayer money, federal money? Do you have any idea what the pollsters intended?
They just said taxpayer. They weren't specific. And that's why I wrote in my column today. It's like, I think that's going to be the real factor. I mean, that's what's going to shape public opinion in Boston about the Olympics. You know, will taxpayer money be used? And I think the problem, frankly, is from Boston 2024, because they've gone out, and even Walsh, right? Mayor Walsh is behind this, said no taxpayer money will be used in, I guess, the operations of the games. But we'll use it for infrastructure. But I can already start to see that, you know, that slippery slope. I can see, you know, public money being used in other ways.
You
know,
they talk about the federal government coming in and doing a lot of and picking up the tab for a lot of the security. But there's not going to be millions of dollars in overtime for the Boston police. There's not going to be situations where the Boston firefighters are called out because of whatever concern there is, or police departments from around the Commonwealth. I mean, up in Lowell, they're going to have the rowing, supposedly, in the Merrimack River. I'm just, like I said a million times, I'm very cynical. I've been a reporter too long. I'm very suspicious.
I mean, I think it's worth exploring when we say security. Well, I think security would be several billions of dollars by 2024. But I don't know if that means that federal government will write a check to cover all of it, or if another town has to cover, you know, part of it. I have no idea. I mean, that's the kind of details that have to be worked out in the next couple years.
And we know how the Republicans love Massachusetts. Wouldn't they love to write a big check to help out the citizenry?
Yeah, but can I tell you, to be fair, though, they do love the Olympics. Most people in Congress, my guess is, love the Olympics. There's a leading Republican. Well, Daryl Issa the other day said, forget about it. I think the story was in the Globe, actually. Mm-hmm. Another key budget chairperson said, Chaffetz or somebody, said, yes, one last thing before we get to the calls, and then stick around with us for a few minutes while we take the calls, Shirley, if you would, is between Marjorie and me, and I'm sure we have asked every single person, from Dan O'Connell to John Fish to Marty Walsh to Charlie Baker, we know you're all operating in good faith. We know you all intend for there to be no additional mm-hmm. public dollars spent other than that which is already in the pipeline for transportation infrastructure. How can you guarantee that? Have you heard a decent answer to that question yet?
Well, you know, in Chicago, they took out an insurance policy. And right now, the Boston 2024 took out a $25 million insurance policy to cover the bid. If we are the host city, I would hope that we would take out an insurance policy that covers us for hundreds of millions of dollars.
Well, not just that, but my understanding is, again, I think I read it in the Globe or somewhere, is that London originally thought that it was going to be a $4.5 billion nut, sort of mm-hmm. similar to the $5 billion nut right. here, and it ended up ballooning by another $10 billion. So is it feasible? You're a former business editor. You know these kind of things. Can they buy a $10 billion insurance policy? Is that doable?
I mean, I don't know if it's doable, but I was looking at some of the numbers last night. I think New York said that they would be on the hook for – they were willing to guarantee $250 million. London said a blank check. Other cities say we will cover whatever it takes. And so, I mean, I think these are all – all the details have to be worked out about the bid, about – I do think it will cost more than $4.5 billion. I think that's just the operations of the games. I think what we need to see is what is the cost of the games all in. And I think it will be closer to $15 billion when you add in security and you add in everything else. Okay. You add in the cost of this financing a stadium, perhaps.
Right.
Okay. And now, last thing, we were told, even though you're going to stay with us, we're told your ride is here,
yeah.
So we're going to lose you in a second. Do you think there should be the public should have the final say on this thing?
You know, they can go ahead and have a vote. I don't know if it will. I don't know if it will stop the process. I mean, I guess if we voted it down, I mean, the IOC could say. I mean, public opinion does matter to the IOC, and they do their own polling in the host cities, candidate cities. I guess if we voted it down, we would get a lower score on that. I mean,
see, my sense is on this, and I surely have not been authorized to speak for the new governor, Charlie Baker. We played
yet,
a soundbite from his appearance yesterday.
Hoping.
He did mention you glowingly, I should say. He criticized you a little bit too, but he praised you too on the Olympics piece he wrote about New York and the value of the planning process, which is in great part what's been said by Walsh and Baker. I have to believe that if there was a public vote, which he said was fine with him, and if it was a no, I'm convinced Charlie Baker would oppose the Olympic effort. I didn't ask him. I have no idea, but he is a huge believer in direct democracy. So my sense is that might derail this whole train.
If there was a vote and it was no.
Yeah, even if it wasn't binding formally, right. Obviously, on the IOC.
I mean, that you could be right on that, you know, but I will be very interested to see. I mean, a vote is very expensive, right, to get to that point. I mean, I don't know about this. I know a statewide vote is.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know if, you know, I don't know how the citywide vote works.
Shirley, we're so glad you were wandering the halls.
Thank you for coming in. And if people haven't seen Shirley's column, it's a terrific column. What days are you in the papers?
Wednesdays and Fridays.
Wednesdays and Fridays. Okay, I wasn't sure the exact days. L-E-U-N-G. Is that correct?
My Twitter's at Leung, L-E-U-N-G.
Ooh, excuse
at
me.
Flies thank you very
Shirley,
much.
Shirley, it's great to see you.
Shirley,
come by again soon.
Thank you very much for stopping by. Our number is 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970. We're going to get back to you guys. What do you think? Should we have a vote for the Olympics?
877. Oh, you said the number. Let's go to the calls. Let's go to Lee in New Bedford. You're up on Boston Public Radio. Hi there, Lee.
Hi, how you doing?
Excellent. Thanks. What do you think?
I know that there's going to be a lot of intangible pros and cons. But when you put a vote out to the public, and a lot of the public is just doesn't have a lot of information, who is truly going to give the pros and cons in an honest way?
Well, based on Lee, as somebody, I can answer your question. As somebody who used to do ballot campaigns for a living, that is me, then if you're concerned, and I think that's a legitimate concern about who informs the public, the spending of money on both sides, then you can make the case that we should never have a ballot campaign. I mean, what's a good example? What was the thing called that was way ahead in the most recent polling and then was outspent like forever to one?
The bottle bill, too.
So, I mean, that is an issue. But so would that cause you to suggest there should never be a popular vote?
No, absolutely not. But in this particular case, If there is, and I'm against taxpayer money being spent for like Gillette Stadium and all that.
Yeah.
But in this particular case, how much money is going to go back into the businesses which are going to pay taxes, which are going to go back into either the state or the city? And when you pay all this overtime for police, this is really what generates economy. These are the people with extra money that buy the clothes, that buy the cars, that buy the houses. So there's a very, very difficult way to really put the benefits of what you gain.
But Lee, that's a powerful argument of the proponents. And I will tell you what the opponents say to that economic activity thing, that Boston is not some podunk town that doesn't have high levels of tourism. And the issue is not how much does the Olympics generate. The issue is how much does the Olympics generate of economic activity over and above that which would be generated anyway by our normal tourism. But Lee, that's a great call, and thank you for it.
Well, it's also similar to what happened in the Big Dig. I mean, many people will tell you that there were thousands and thousands of construction workers who got to live very good lives, afford to pay, send their kids to college, afford to buy a nice house, and that was all terrific. But the problem is, all these years later, the people that live in the western part of Massachusetts are stuck with these massive tolls on the Massachusetts Turnpike, which take a huge chunk out of their paycheck every week, and we are stuck on the with a crummy T, and we're stuck with the crummy T in large part because we're still paying off the bills of the big dig. So it's a real problem. I want to point out, Don just sent us an email, give a shout out to the New Yorker, which apparently is running a piece now about who gets to vote in Boston. It's talking about the pros and cons of a vote in Boston. So people should check it out. I just skimmed it really quickly. It's a great piece. Don, thank you for sending that to us.
I think it's, you know, I haven't heard at all, other than Marty Walsh's opposition, I haven't heard what any of the leaders of the Olympics bid themselves have said about a popular vote. It's pretty hard to argue that we're going to have all these public meetings. We want public input. I think there's some meeting at the convention center or something like that to get the advisory committee of citizens, real people involved. How do you argue for those and then argue against the public having an opportunity to vote on the entire question?
There is going to be a vote.
You think there will be?
Yeah, I do.
You think they'll collect signatures?
I think that the more the opposition gets going and talks about the risks here, I think that there will be a vote.
Also, I think there's going to be pressure on people like Charlie Baker, by the way, who supports,
and Marty Walsh,
who basically supports the thing, and Marty Walsh. You're right, even though he's against the vote right now, to say let the people ultimately decide.
As the gentleman from Everett pointed out, what's the difference? You know, we're talking about voting in the casinos. You're not going to vote in the Olympics. I mean, it doesn't seem to make sense. I think to most people. Anyway, we can't talk about the Olympics anymore today. But I'm sure we're going to be talking about the Olympics almost
nonstop.
Can I ask
you one last question before we leave this? If there was, as we were just discussing with Shirley Leung, extraordinarily good business columnist for the Boston Globe, if there was a $10 billion insurance policy for overruns, I'm just asking as a hypothetical, if they said there was a $10 billion insurance policy, wouldn't your cynicism and opposition disappear?
Here's what I think.
What's the answer?
I don't want the – Boston is a great city.
So you don't want it anyway.
We have a lot going for us. We don't need to have the Olympics in Boston. We don't need to take our eyes off the ball. We have real problems in Boston that we talk about all the time. And the schools is the biggest one of them. And if you think the schools in Boston are going to be helped in any way by the Olympic bids coming here, unless they build new schools or they – or something.
Got it.
I just don't think it's fair. I think we're taking our eyes off the ball. Anyway, coming up, Boston Globe columnist Alex Beam joins us. That's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Joining us, as he does every week for Open Mic, is Boston Globe columnist Alex Beam. And as you know, as Marjorie and I do every time Alex is scheduled to be here, we marvel at the fact that his name is Alex Beam. And today, I think it was Marjorie who was marveling, because just like Alex, the African gray parrot, Alex Beam is famous for his way with words and cognitive supremacy. I was the one that said cognitive supremacy. Marjorie's the one who mentioned your way with words. Alex, great to see you.
Olympics are boring. Olympics are boring. Hey, what have you guys been talking about?
We have been talking about, as you just noticed, the Olympics, which you seem to find very boring. But it fits into your theme of yesterday's column about the naysayers in Boston and our fussiness. I'm a big Olympic naysayer, Alex. Now,
what are you on this?
I've picked up on that. I'm keeping my powder dry, right? Because it's going to be, another 2.5 years of talk radio and, like, empty-minded Boston Globe columns.
So yes.
Why would you want to commit this early? You'd want to be able to write for both sides.
So do you have a position and you're not telling us, or you don't have a position?
I want to see which way the wind blows, like Charlie Baker, right? I heard
I
him.
Knew
yes,
this.
He has his finger, in the air, so to speak. Why not wait and see where the strength lies, i.e. who's going to pay the most? That's the key, because especially if it comes down to a referendum, they're going to need, paid scribblers to back up their point of view, and I'm definitely available.
So you're a big Baker fan. We know that. I think we've said
that.
What did you think of Baker yesterday?
I thought he was – first of all, I didn't hear the whole thing. Second of all –
it's online if you want to hear it.
Please.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I have nothing to do with my time.
How was what you heard?
I thought he – uncharacteristically, I'm channel. I thought he was pretty waffly on the Olympics, right? There was this kind of note of hurt feelings that he hadn't seen the bid, et cetera, which was of course interesting, and you jumped on that. The thing about he said the people have the right, of course, to file a referendum. I thought he's really keeping his powder dry. I thought.
Well, he's got a huge reason because it's going to be taking money. I think he's worried about the money. He's supposed to be Mr. Fiscal Manage everything, and how much of your money is going to be going to something that may not be going someplace else.
Yeah, I thought about this. Yeah, it's incredible to think that I would actually prepare for this exchange, but I actually gave this some thought. I mean, he has no choice, though. It doesn't matter. Even Deval Patrick, Charlie, but it doesn't matter. The governor is going to have to come down in support.
Why do you say that?
Because it is inarguably, quote unquote, good for the state. It is. Yes.
Is it inarguably good for the state?
Look,
Alex?
I'm a calcified enemy of progress.
Yeah.
I mean, let's
we know
let's
that.
Make the, okay. Thank you. I don't want anything to change. Massachusetts. I did a whole that thing. I was so disturbed to learn that our population is growing. I was sat here for 20 years, so happy that our population was declining. I said, great, fewer people, beat it. Go to Alabama. I could care less. Now our population is growing. Everything's doing well, right? Jobs are on the uptake. I mean, look, I heard you actually in the previous hour talking about the big dig. I mean, I get it. Sean Murphy's my friend. Okay, fine. But the
fabulous investigative reporter at the Boston Globe, for those who don't know.
I mean, the fact is that the big dig has been a net plus for us. You can get angry at me, you can say you're wrong. Okay, I've been wrong before, but it's been a net plus.
By the way, I agree with that, but that's not the issue. I think you're asking the wrong question. The question is, if the legislature and the public in 1990, whatever year it was, said this big thing that's going to be a huge, what did Paul Cellucci call it, a marvel of engineering,
going
to speed traffic through the city
Which
to the airport.
Hasn't.
Well, to the airport it has.
The airport,
yeah.
For the western suburbs. But wait a second. For the western suburbs, it has been a net plus.
It's going to cost $15 or $16 billion. Then people can make an informed decision. The issue here, to me, is not whether I happen to be in the camp that believes if the Olympics did happen, despite the traffic congestion, et cetera, we'd be happy it was here. But we wouldn't be happy if it was here if $4.5 or $5 billion became $18 billion. That's really the issue, don't you think?
No, I don't. But I hear you. I mean, I think a guy we know, the ultimate cynic, Bill Weld, in 1991, knew what was going to happen with the big dig. He knew that these $2 to $3 billion were, but he's like the Charlie Baker of 1991.
No, there's another. You want to explain? You give your Joe Malone answer to Alex Bean.
Oh, Joe Malone. I'm going to get it wrong, but mostly right. He talked about the big dig as being this huge champagne glass.
This is Joe Malone, the former
treasurer.
In which
everybody jumped. The politicians, the lobbyists,
of both parties,
the lawyers, the construction companies, and everybody who's floating in this bubbly sea of
You're
money
right.
coming
I get
in.
It. That's a beautiful image. But all I'm saying is that Weld knew that and chose to be silent. That Weld had seen that movie before.
Yeah.
And now it's the same movie. I'm not really disagreeing with you. But Baker is the Weld of our time. He's Republican governor. I mean, our worst fears, I think, about the Olympics will be realized, but also our kind of, it'll be great afterwards. It'll be like a date with Alex Beam. You're so happy it's over. but you went out with Alex Beam, so that was okay. I mean, the Olympics, I don't know. I think I just you have a new governor, you have a youngish mayor. We got to go for it, I think.
So just did take your position after saying I'm going to keep my powder dry. You just wrote your column essentially.
Well, I mean, yeah, my next 50 column.
Okay, fine,
exactly.
Yeah, it is good for the biz. I think there is going to be a lot of endless hand-wringing about the Olympics pro and con for the next however 2017.
And you're right. I mean, these guys will have their hands in our pockets. There's no doubt about that.
Now, speaking of naysaying, we want to move on to man slamming very quickly, but I you're Mr. Fussy. And you're Mr. Naysayer. Just a word or two about the protest yesterday in 93. Does this fit into your naysaying world, Alex?
I heard you guys talking about that. Wow. Yeah. I don't know. Yeah,
Marjorie's flipped her position.
Yeah, I didn't know what her previous position was. Yeah, I will flip it within about 2.6 minutes. I don't know. Like the 27-year-old anarchist, of course, in me, supports these kinds of radical actions. On the other, I mean, I don't, I guess it's a lot like Occupy,
I loved Occupy, actually.
See, I didn't. I wasn't down with Occupy.
Yeah.
And since Occupy, everyone said it was a really important moment in American history. I don't know. But I tell you, I'm going to straddle this as well.
Okay.
I mean, because, there really hasn't been much outrage about killing unarmed African-American citizens of our country. That I've experienced, I don't see anybody really changing their behavior particularly.
I think the reason you were down with Occupy, you didn't go down there with me because there was a guy that was selling these 9,000 different kinds of seaweed, and he had it all arranged on this whiteboard. You could buy seaweed for $3.50 a packet, and it was going to cure all your ills and stuff like that. It was a fun time down at Occupy.
I have a great Occupy story, but I'm going to wait till I'm 65 years
old. Oh, come on!
No, I can't tell it. I can't tell.
So can I sum up where we are so far?
Yeah,
so Alex Bean does not have a position on the Olympics.
Right.
He doesn't have a position on the protesters, which leads me to conclude, why is he here? Let's try this.
Exactly.
He's supposed to be an opinion writer, is he not?
Alex, you are an expert on all expressions that begin with the word M-A-N. Now, could you explain three to us, please? There's, of course, mansplaining. There's, of course, manspreading, and no one did it better than Bill Clinton on the cover of Esquire years ago, and manslamming. Please start with the first one and run through the list for us.
Man, this could be tiresome.
Go ahead. Okay. Not for me.
No, well, manspreading is a big deal in New York City, on the New York City subways.
Subways, yeah.
I think it's not that big a deal here. I don't quite get all the hoopla about manspreading. There's something kind of weird.
Well, explain what it is.
Well, in New York, everyone's kind of teed off because men sit with sort of in a relaxed position and with their thighs and knees sort of open.
Open.
Yeah.
Like if they're wearing a kilt, it would be a deal.
It is okay. A problem.
But they're not wearing kilts. They're wearing pants. I was just on the New York subway like a lot last week. I didn't see that much man spreading.
Mm-hmm.
I was, however, in New York. I'm proud to say I heard the term mansplaining used in the wild.
You did?
Really?
Yes. I was actually at an event.
Do tell.
It was incredible. It was a friend of mine was doing a presentation of a book called The Best American Infographics. Of two,
wow.
Yeah, well, yeah, okay, I know.
Why don't you tell us about that in advance?
Yeah, I was about to say. Wow, radio dials being turned all over Massachusetts. But no, so there was this incredibly... prestigious former Time magazine art director who was holding forth, and a woman got up and asked a question, and he in fact lectured her in a really condescending way, like she was stupid. And to be fair, mansplaining is a great term because men do this a lot. You know, it's
really.
Oh yeah,
I had not noticed.
Let me tell you, Marjorie. I'll explain it.
Oh, thank you.
Anyway, this guy, they had this back and forth, and this perfectly reasonable woman. I said, you know, that's enough with the mansplaining. And I thought, wow, only in New York City are you going to see this like jump off the pages of the Atlantic website. And anyway, as for the last one. Was it
man slamming? Yes.
Man slamming.
Oh yeah, God! Women really have like an endless series of.
No, but I've seen this. I've never heard the term, but I've seen this. Go ahead, describe.
Really?
It. Yeah, I have.
I don't know. I mean that whole thing about who yields to you on the sidewalk. I can't. Is it really gender based?
Because men do stake out a position. I think this is true. You stake out a position, and it's almost like you're playing hockey.
But we haven't
or
explained the term yet.
Well, go. You explain it. Well, that's why you're here.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
I thought I was here to actually not have opinions about anything.
What is man slamming?
Well, man slamming apparently is this notion that you're on a crowded sidewalk, and the man will always, in a sense, pursue the forward course, and a woman. But almost by instinct, I guess it's implied, we'll get out of that person's way. But I tell you, I have a lot to add on this because I now have a policy of bumping into people on their iPhones whose heads are down. I will simply slam into them to teach them a lesson.
That's excellent.
Now, I think that's called phone slamming, right, or something like
that. It's a little hostile.
It's a little hostile. A little but don't hostile? You find that to be? There's
it's
some.
Do we have to mansplain this to you?
Hostile. No, you can see the impulse there when they had buried.
And they're wandering around. They're not walking in a straight line. They're approaching the light on the corner. I totally buy
that. It's second only to biking on a sidewalk, but that we can reserve a separate 30 minutes for that discussion. But speaking of man slamming, I think since we're talking about, apparently there's some like fake sociological research, right, that's backstopping this notion.
Yes.
That supposedly women are more likely to yield.
To move, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I think that you hear this all the time. I mean, what's her name from Facebook that wrote Lean In?
Cheryl Sandberg,
thank you very much. She just wrote a piece about this in The Globe, I think, or maybe it was the New York Times. I get it mixed up. But talking about this where people in these, you know, all these company get together and talk ideas and how women always get talked over and how the woman's idea, she presents her idea and everybody kind of goes, says nothing. And the man presents a variation on the exact same idea like 40 seconds later, and it's brilliant. And everybody says, oh, it's great. And the women were talking about how men seem not to notice this. And, you know, I think there's something to that, I would like
I sort
to
of agree.
Say.
I just don't know about the side. I'm a sidewalk yielder, you know, so I don't, that's why I'm not a man slammer.
Yeah.
And I'm always sort of looking, you know, who's coming to the sidewalk. And you know, a lot of people are really, really assertive, and you've just got to get out of their way.
Well, I think also sometimes it's a young man kind of thing. It's more of a young man kind of thing than an older
man. Slamming, I would argue it's an older man kind of thing.
Really?
It's sort
you think
of a
so?
Set. It's the particularly older white men who are upset about losing their power in every single sort of way.
Okay.
One of the places where you can maintain your dominance is on the sidewalk.
I think the older white men are holding on pretty well. That's
can I tell you one thing that's interesting here, Marjorie? Because you probably aren't as observant on this
okay,
as
Jim,
I am.
Okay, Jim, thank you. You're going to mansplain it to me.
I'm going
to
mansplain
it to you. I am here to be mansplained,
I'm going to explain it. Well, I think afterwards you'll thank me.
So far,
there
in our
be
time
no
with
doubt
Alex,
about that.
Alex has no position on the Olympics.
That's right.
He has no position on the protests, which are arguably the two most important issues in Massachusetts today. Yet he has a passionate position on man slamming. What does that say about you, Alex? Would you say?
Well, it just says, I'm a perfectly well balanced human being.
Yeah.
I thought, there's a lot of things that even more important that I don't care about.
Like what?
I don't actually care about who's in the White House that much.
That's not
you
true.
Don't?
That is really not true.
No.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, yeah.
So if Jeb Bush runs against Hillary Clinton, which right now are the odds, but I mean, let's do you care
well,
if Jeb Bush or
didn't
Hillary?
You see Mike Huckabee? How'd you like to have him
no,
at the
stop
White House?
It. Didn't you see the last readable op-ed piece in the Boston Globe came out about 6 weeks ago, written by a Tufts professor? It was utterly fascinating.
About what?
He said it was what he was doing was riffing on what used to be called the national security state.
What's his name?
I forget.
I didn't see it. Go
That's
ahead.
Very
came
useful.
Out 6 weeks ago. No, he made a very interesting point.
What was the point?
He said, one of his questions was, I mean, how come the NSA is the same under Obama?
Oh, I did see the piece. It's sort of the shadow government notion that the real government never changes, regardless who
that
the
was
CEO
piece,
is. Yeah. I'm sorry.
Okay, last readable piece in the Boston
Globe.
You are
terrible. They were
that made any
columns
sense
today.
And had something to say. And I mean, that was darned interesting. I actually emailed him because I was curious. You know, did he feel that whatever he was saying, did that apply to domestic policy as well? And he just prevaricated. I don't know. He was pushing a book, of course, about the shadow government. Uh-oh.
Emily just sent me an in solidarity email about mansplaining. I'm not going to tell you. She just
Emily Rooney?
She's in solidarity. No, an emailer.
Oh, Emily, okay.
She's, thank you, Emily, for your support.
Okay, fine. Enough of her. Yeah. Now, let Alex,
maybe
the NSA.
Some explaining to do.
Speaking of the NSA, do you have a position on this whole encryption issue that's happening with smart? You don't have a position on this either. This whole smartphone thing, everybody's upset. Everybody, the government and prosecutors are apparently upset because there's this new encryption technology that's going into these new smartphones because some people, namely people who are paying attention, are concerned about the ability of the government without a warrant to go into your phone and get all this information. You're not concerned about this either?
I am. All I'm concerned about is that I want to write a column and I want to have a really good graphic with the iPhone in it. Because I wouldn't say I'm concerned, but I'm fascinated about how the iPhone is suddenly kind of at the focus of a lot of legal concerns.
Because your whole life is in your phone.
Exactly.
Your whole life.
Right. And I mean, encryption is very challenging for lay people. I'm reasonably certain that the serious hackers in Kharkov, where it seems to me all serious hackers live, you know, could get past Apple's, you know, measly encryption. Obviously, the Albuquerque police force is worried that they can't get past it, et cetera, et cetera. What interests me, and I don't like, haven't really completely thought this through, is how the iPhone and the search warrant as it relates to the iPhone is becoming a stand-in for your house, your automobile, your lugs, as they used to call them on Law and Order. Like, it occurred to me, do they archive geopositioning data? The answer is probably not. But suppose they did. Wouldn't that be? They would know where you'd been, like, the past 36 hours, et cetera,
yeah.
et cetera. So I'm kind of intrigued. Like, the Supreme Judicial Court just did a ruling in the Hernandez case about his iPhone. I mean, that's kind of huge.
That it will not be. That they can't use that as evidence, correct?
Yeah. That was a well-done Globe article, but that's kind of crazy because by taking, it's as we know, I mean, here is one. By taking this tiny thing, smaller than a pack of cards, off the table, as it will, you take all of Hernandez's communications.
Yeah, but what you're doing, Alex, you're making the mistake, I think, of looking, and it was either the SJC or the Supreme Court of the United States, and my apologies to people, I'm sure we'll get an email saying I should know, and I should, recently made a decision, I think it was the U.S. Supreme Court, on the whole issue of a phone is not a phone anymore. When a phone was a phone, I think your point was valid. This is like searching your smartphone without a warrant is exactly the same as searching your house without a warrant. I mean, there's no difference. Well, your house, if not even more intimately is in that little device in your hand.
Here's
yes?
the question. Now in the days after the terrible terrorist attacks in Paris, people, of course, are thinking very much about terrorist chatter and the back and forth. So what's the deal for the government with suspected terrorists?
Go get a warrant.
But there are hundreds of them. Is that the deal? You have to go to the FISA court and get the warrant?
I agree with you, but it's in a way, it's the point is, I think the American legal system is still groping, coming to grips with the idea of the smartphone.
I agree. They're trying to catch up.
And that's what interests me, in that it's new law. The Supreme Court will be back, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, as you well know, you're a great arguer. You're like a Clintonian arguer because you leave out the facts that don't accommodate
of course,
you.
Yes.
There was a search warrant in the Hernandez case, mm-hmm. a valid search warrant.
Oh, there
warrant.
Was.
Yeah. And his idiot defense lawyer handed the phone over
voluntarily, without examining it.
That's
exactly right.
You know, so this, I don't know. I got no answers. I'm just genuinely interested in this. Is a whole new sort of legal category, it seems to me, of considerable interest to me.
And by the way, in considerable interest to us as well, we've talked about these issues. Now, okay, we've reached this point where the Alex being an explainer happens. This is where Alex takes something theoretically that people are wondering about. Usually they're not, but in this case, they may be. And the issue that you're going to confront today, which I think is important and relevant, what exactly is the Boston 2024 Olympics logo? What is that thing? Go ahead. You have 45 seconds starting. Not yet. Wait a couple seconds. Now.
Wow. Well, this is something I have a really strong opinion
on. Good.
Finally, yeah, good. After the protests.
Good.
No, I mean, well, it's hideous. I mean, it's too bad we're not on TV. It's an astonishingly awful Olympics mm-hmm. logo. Well, the first point you need, it looks like an orifice. That's the key.
It does, yeah, it does.
So then you get to, what can you talk about on radio? What orifice is it? I think I've come up with the answer. I think it looks a lot like the sort of the unimouth that was on the sandworms in the movie Dune, and I don't want to just plug the movie Dune because, mm-hmm. of course, the novels were so great. But now, I don't know, maybe I can tell you're not reacting. What about the beak?
I didn't see
what
it.
About the beak on the squid in 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, the original Disney? That was the most horrifying thing you've ever seen. It came up to the Nautilus.
Yes,
it had this
I remember
horrible
that.
Beak. Well, that's what the Boston Olympics.
So you think that's what their goal is, to achieve some like connection
to
in people's minds?
Upset everybody? Is that their goal?
I mean, obviously they have to redesign that, right? I mean,
okay.
Before they get to.
Well, can I give you an extra?
Hold on. Is the unimouth and Dune an attractive mouth, or is it not?
No, it's hideous. The sandworms come and they. Oh God!
I didn't see the movie.
Oh, I'm really disappointed. Yeah. It's a terrible movie. But
well, wait a second.
The sandworms are utterly horrifying.
We're going to give you an extra 15 seconds. Have you done enough reporting to know what were they trying to achieve in terms of the Boston 2024?
I'm like Charlie Baker. I've been totally locked out. I'm serious. No, there's no information about who came up with this logo. If you Google it, what's weird is, you know, you come across this incredibly beautiful logo that apparently was surfaced in 2012 by a different group.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, kind of a hopeful, incipient group. And they have a gorgeous logo that has a multicolored sail.
Oh.
And on the bottom of the multicolored sail is more grass. Sort of,
I actually remember
it
this.
It sort of
now,
hints at leaves to me. It seems to hint at sort of autumn leaves. It's so it's time for...
okay, we have
logo
to leave.
Too.
Alex weighs in strongly on the logo.
And unimouth. Alex Beam is a columnist for the Boston Globe. His latest book, American Crucifixion, The Murder of Joseph Smith, Fate of the Mormon Church. Up next, we are going to talk about whether or not you are qualified to be a juror on the Tsarnaev trial. That's next. Stay tuned.
Local conversation is still to come with Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan on Boston Public Radio. That's coming right up after a news update from NPR. Thanks for listening today here on 89.7 WGBH.
Funding for our programs comes from you and Worcester Art Museum's Flora in Winter, January 29 through February 1st, featuring spectacular art-inspired floral displays throughout the museum, plus tours, demonstrations, and special events. More at worcesterart.org. And Basic Black. Join Callie Crossley and the region's sharpest observers of current events for a discussion on the latest topics impacting Black communities. Don't miss Basic Black, tonight at 7:30 on WGBH 2.
I'm reporter Adam Riley, and you and I are listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH, WGBH HD1 Boston, online at WGBHnews.org. Boston's local NPR.
We kick off the noon hour of today's BPR. Jury selection proceeds in the Tsarnaev trial. We'll ask you the question the judge in the case must determine the answer to. Could you be a fair and impartial juror?
Callie Crossley on the oh-so-white Oscar nominations. Live performance in studio by Dwight Richer from the Dwight Richer Band, which is now in town. Emily Rooney on her famous list, plus her rants from the Tsarnaev trial, and getting a head start on National Cheese Lovers Day. Our Friday news quiz will feature two local cheesemakers. All that coming up on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Jim Browdy, I am Marjorie Egan. Welcome to hour number two of Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Hello, Jim.
Hey there, Marjorie. So we're in the midst of jury selection, as everybody knows, in the Jahar Tsarnaev trial. And as you know, a huge concern for the defense team is that it would be impossible to find impartial jurors in Boston. Not jurors, by the way, who don't know anything about it, but who could judge fairly and impartially the evidence. Jurors who hadn't been exposed to the endless reporting on the bombings, on the Tsarnaev brothers themselves, and the reach the bombings had from the campus at UMass to Ibrahim Todashev's FBI interrogation gone fatally wrong, obviously, in Orlando, Florida. But according to a column by Kevin Cullen of the Boston Globe today, this is pretty amazing, who's been covering the trial, there are plenty of prospective jurors who were not tuned in, but rather tuned out. Which is pretty depressing, I should say.
Jim, they weren't listening to us.
Well, or anybody else. So the question is, could this be you? But more important question is, if the judge were to say to you, Judge O'Toole were to say, after questioning you, could you fairly and impartially judge just the evidence presented in this trial to make a determination about the guilt or innocence of Jahar Tsarnaev, could you answer that question in the affirmative? The answer, the number is 877-301-8970. Could you be a fair and impartial juror in the Tsarnaev case? You probably know, if you didn't know this before, that there are two phases, potentially. If he's found not guilty, then there's not a second phase. If he's found guilty, then there's a death penalty phase. Is he given the death penalty? And what you may have just learned in the last 24 hours, if during the voir dire, the questioning of the jurors by, in this case, the judge, if you say you're against the death penalty, you're out.
Right.
It's only people who are in favor of the death penalty, which, you know, they're not saying they're in favor of the death penalty in this case, but in favor of the death penalty, which seems to me to be a little bit of an imbalance. But that's not really our issue. Our issue is not about the death penalty. Our issue is about the fundamental question in round one. Could you fairly and impartially judge the innocence or guilt of Jahar Tsarnaev?
But one thing about the death penalty, though, is Collins Colin mentioned that the chief reason cited for people being unable to sit in the jury is their opposition to the death penalty. Even
half
in
of them so far, the 20 that they did yesterday.
Which is pretty significant. And I think two women that were lawyers said that they could not couldn't do it if it was their own kid, and they maybe with somebody else's kid, but they just could not bring themselves the death penalty. And the other person I thought was interesting said if there were ever a chance of his escaping, yes, they could do it, but they don't think he would escape in 2015.
Did you see what the first juror yesterday questioned by the judge had to say, and I'm paraphrasing,
what?
That his friends thought it would be, quote, cool if he voted to sentence Jahar Tsarnaev to death.
I don't think he's going to make it. Do you
cool.
think he's going to make
877-301-8970. Before we get to this, you know, I am a lawyer. I actually sat on a jury once. You did too, right?
Yes, I did.
Could you?
I almost got on the second one.
Could you fairly and impartially judge the guilt or innocence of Tsarnaev? See, I'm where you are. I would love to say, of course I could. I don't know if I could.
You saw the pictures. You know,
exactly.
You saw him on television. You saw him in the newspapers. I don't know how I could possibly find him not guilty.
See, my attitude about this thing is, which is not our question, but since I brought it up, I'll say it anyway, that not having a change in venue. And by the way, the judge was against it. Ultimately, after doing a lot of these voir dire, these questionings, he could change his mind. Everybody's got a connection to this. You're either at the marathon, you're in Greater Boston, you're in Watertown. Your kids, like mine, went to school with the kid, with the younger Tsarnaev. Everybody's got a connection to this.
The only way, I suppose, if they were to prove, which I don't think they're going to prove, but if he were under some sort of death threat from Tamerlan or something, whether he was
that's going to be part of the defense, don't you think?
Well, I think they're going to say he was influenced by
not
his,
a death row, I'm sorry,
his brother, but I don't think he could rise because, of course, everybody knows Johar went to UMass and he was down there with his friends and he was out of the house.
But that's not the question during the voir dire. The voir dire is not, okay, so is there, you know, is there a little bitty part of a possible defense? The question is, could you fairly and impart, essentially what they're saying to you, unless you are you've been asleep for 20 years, you know something, if not a lot, about this case. You may even been affected, which, by the way, does not cause you to be ruled out. The question is, can you convince the judge, and I guess they have challenges too, the lawyers on both sides, can you convince the powers that be that despite what you know, you can block all that out, listen to only what happens that's admitted testimony and make a decision based on that? I have to say, and I don't question the integrity of anybody, I don't see how anybody from this region, I don't see how anybody can do that, even if it's only a subliminal problem.
Well, we got someone on the phone who thinks he absolutely could. That would be Tom in the car. Hey, Tom, thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hey, good afternoon. How you doing?
Very well. Thank you for calling.
So yeah, you can do it.
Yeah, absolutely, because he's going to have an attorney that is going to try and sway, and it's basically the opinion of the jury is really what it comes down to. Sure, absolutely. You know, the only thing would be is that I think it prevents a lot of people from sitting on a trial like this is the amount of time that it takes.
Oh, sure.
The problem. And well, as one friend of mine who served on a jury said, he goes, you know who serves on juries? And I says, I have no idea. He says, old people and people in disability. That's who serves on juries. That's supposed to mean.
Can I tell you, Tom? I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
No, you finish. I'm sorry. I thought you were. Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, I said, what's that supposed to mean? He goes, because when it's a lengthy trial, that's who you get from the jury pool. And everybody in the jury pool, for the most part, who works for a living, comes up with an excuse. And one coworker had the best one about getting out of jury duty. And they asked, they said, he cleared one hurdle. And they said, does anybody have any questions? And he goes, yes, I do. And they go ahead, sir. And he says, is this the same system that found O.J. Simpson not guilty? And he goes, yes, it is. He goes, I want no part of it. And he goes, you're dismissed.
Hey, Tom, before you go away, how are you so certain that you could do this fairly? Why are you? I'm not questioning your certainty, but why are you so certain you could do this?
My general nature is to be open-minded.
Okay. Fair enough. Tom, thanks for the call. We appreciate it.
I don't want to get off on a side issue, but there is a good argument to be made that the government should pay a lot more money to jurors to sit on juries. Because
I couldn't agree more.
How can you go for 3 or 4 months if you have a job with a
Well, aren't
stipend?
Employers, even on the federal side, aren't they required to continue to pay you? I think they are. I think they – well, we should check that. Can somebody check that, if you don't mind, of our colleagues, about whether or not in state courts, in Massachusetts in particular, but in federal courts, if your employer, if you're on a jury, is required to continue paying you? We'll find out in a
second.
Someone
said today their employer told them they're going to start paying their own health insurance.
Then maybe I'm wrong. 877-301-8970. The problem is it's really a disrupting influence. When I served on a jury, which I'm so glad I did, by the way, everybody should have the experience at least once. I was there a day and a half or something.
I mean, most of the things are really short. Yeah. I mean, most things are not – even the Hernandez trial, I don't think that will go on for that long. I mean, there's a sort of trial because they have to have not only the – as we just said, not only the is he guilty and then is he going to be put to death. I mean, there's going to be two trials.
Separate
trials.
Going to be the same
assuming jury
he's convicted, right.
For both trials. Anyway, Phil in Connecticut. What do you think, Phil?
Hey, Phil.
Hey, how you doing today, guys?
Great.
Good. My thought is I'd like to think that I could be impartial. I could listen to the evidence presented. My concern would be, and as we've seen of late in other juries that have come about recently, is what the repercussions would be should the defense present the evidence that would lead you to believe that he's not guilty of the crime that the prosecution is saying he's guilty of. And you find him not guilty.
You mean as a juror, would you be in danger of some kind of blowback? Yeah. Is that what you're asking?
Absolutely. That would be a big concern. I mean, and that was, again, in my thinking, one of the reasons that a change of venue was so necessary. How many people that are on that jury or will be selected for that jury walked around for the longest time with Boston Strong bracelets on or T-shirts or...
Yeah,
flew the flag for whatever reason. And now they're going to be on that jury and be impartial. I'd like to think I could and listen to the evidence. But if the prosecution doesn't present the evidence in a compelling manner.
So if your friends and neighbors would be appalled that you could possibly acquit the guy who was the alleged bomber that caused so much destruction and damage in Boston. I mean, that's a great point.
Thanks, Phil.
When they have the television cameras – television cameras. Forget it. They don't even have television cameras here. They're not going to show the jurors, in case people don't know that. And they're going to not release
like in the Hernandez case, which is on, be on television.
They're not. They don't show their faces in state court where they can have TVs. They're not going to show the judge. Matter of fact, when they took the reporters out of the courtroom the other day when they were first interviewing some of the jurors, the reporters didn't get to see them either. They went to the overflow courtroom where all they could see was Tsarnaev and the lawyers. And they do not disclose their names either. But it's true that your family would know and your neighbors would know and you're probably people at work would know. I mean, imagine if you got in the Tsarnaev jury.
I agree.
Everybody would be talking about it at your office.
By the way, this doesn't apply to federal courts, but in terms of Massachusetts, Marjorie is right. Mass.gov says that in Massachusetts, the employer pays you regular wages just for the first 3 days you're out on jury duty. Then after that, the state pays you $50 a day. That is a huge, for most people, a huge
penalty. Well, that's what lots of people do claim financial hardship. They just can't afford to be in a jury trial for that long. So they should definitely, especially for these jurors in Tsarnaev. It's crazy.
Well, I don't know what the federal rules are. We're going to find out what they are in a couple of seconds.
Let's go to Kara in Cambridge. Hi, Kara.
Hello, Kara.
Hi, it's Tara. Sorry.
Oh, Tara. Sorry. Hi, Tara.
No worries. So I think that I definitely could. I was there that day. My partner was actually, at the time, was actually down volunteering at the finish line. Mm. But the information that came in while we were secluded in our apartment was so fast and so disjointed that I have been left wondering since that day whether the information I've received was correct or not. The police were pressured to take that manhunt so quickly that I honestly don't know myself.
So wait a second. We weren't even considering someone like you. I was assuming that the vast majority of people were utterly convinced of his guilt and had to put that aside. You're not even convinced of Tsarnaev's guilt.
I am more convinced than not that it is probably him, but his involvement. The level.
What's the doubt? If I may, Kara, what is the basis, Tara? I'm sorry. Where are the holes? Forget the trial for the moment. As a citizen, what were the holes in your knowledge or perception of this that caused you to say you're not convinced? I'm just curious.
My perception is that both of the brothers definitely were involved in this. I think that the older brother. Was it Jokhar Tsarnaev?
No, Tamerlan, the older. Jahar is the younger one, yeah.
Yeah. My impression was that he was the younger brother that tagged along with his older brother.
Well, that's it. By the way, that's, as Marjorie said before, we don't know that. We assume that's the primary defense, is that he was under the influence of a dominating, physically imposing older brother. But
I don't know that he was physically imposing or not. My worry is that you don't want, especially when execution is on the line, you don't want to put this person who may have been under the influence to a jury that, I mean, I would say that I would give him the benefit of the doubt.
Got it. We hear it. And by the way, Tara, just for whatever it's worth, Judy Clark, who's one of the most famous lawyers, not in terms of actual trials, but in terms of the penalty phase, where she's been wildly successful in getting people who are facing death penalty life in prison. No one doubts that if he's convicted in round one, that the primary argument, one of the primary arguments in round two is exactly what you're suggesting. Tara, thank you much for the call. And by the way, there's no evidence of that. We're just, that is the assumption as to what the arguments will be made. In terms of the physical imposing, I don't know if he imposed his physical will, but as we know, Tamerlan wanted to be an Olympic boxer.
Well, the other thing you wonder if they're going to find a way to slip in, and this would be against the rules, of course, but oftentimes lawyers do slip in things that the jury gets to hear that really shouldn't get to hear.
Like what?
Well, that Tamerlan was involved as a suspect in the...
They're never going to get that into this trial.
They're not going to get it in a
You mean in the triple murder in Waltham?
I would think you would try to get some information in there somewhere. It will be against the rules. will be viewed out of order. The judge will say you are instructed to ignore what you just heard from defense attorney so-and-so. But they can sneak things in cleverly to let the jury know things they shouldn't know. And what things the jury could know, if they find a way to do it, is that he was a chief suspect or one of the chief suspects in a triple murder, which would add further to the intimidating factor that they would say Tamerlan posed for his younger brother. And as you say, he was a boxer. By the way, federal jurors are paid, our crack staff just found this out, $40 a day. After 10 days, they are paid $50 a day. Federal employees, however, are paid their regular salaries for working on a jury for as long as it lasts. So we would assume that a lot of the jurors up there in the Tsarnaev trial
are not
federal.
For...
They're going to be federal employees so that they can get their salaries.
No, I would assume that's not the – you know, one of the interesting questions –
another side benefit.
And next time we have a defense lawyer or a prosecutor on the show, the question we should ask him vis-a-vis the alleged involvement of Tamerlan Tsarnaev along with Todashev, the guy who was killed by the FBI in Florida in his apartment, in the alleged involvement in the triple murder in – alleged committing of the triple murder in Waltham, is, well, I'm quite sure – I haven't tried cases in a couple of decades that that's not admissible. And in the defense or innocence phase, would that be admissible in the penalty phase?
I don't know.
And I would bet the answer is yes. But if there's a defense lawyer or prosecutor listening, give us a buzz. 877-301-8970.
But I'm sorry. In the real world of trials, admissible or not, people try to get things in.
I would argue that that is significant enough that if the defense attempted to slide that in the regular trial, I would argue that would be grounds for mistrial. That is so prejudicial. It is just unbelievable. In any case, we're talking about whether or not you, if you were on this jury panel, believe that you could fairly and impartially judge the evidence in the Jahar Tsarnaev case.
Joan from Framingham. Hi, Joan.
Hello, Joan.
Hi, Marjorie and Jim. I went out of the country 3 years ago, and when I came back, I couldn't find you guys anymore. So I was so happy that you guys are here now.
Sorry.
Oh,
thank you, Joan.
So, yeah,
very nice
we are too.
I think the judge is crazy. I think he's crazy, and I think he's setting up the defense for an appeal because I don't think you're going to find an unbiased jury. But I'm a little confused. If the death penalty, which I know it's on the table, that might make a difference because not everybody is for the death penalty.
Yeah, but if you say during the voir dire that you are against the death penalty, you're disqualified from the whole case. It's only those people who are open to imposing the death penalty, not saying they would, but open to imposing it, that can even get past round one in this case, Joan.
Yeah, but I still think that the federal judge is setting up for the defense to have an appeal because there is no way you are going to get, although, you know, I've listened to a few of your callers, but very, very difficult, I think, to get an unbiased jury.
So I happen to be with you, and I also don't see the downside. I was asking Randy Chapman, who's an experienced trial lawyer, last night on television. Even if the judge believes this, why not err on the side of moving the trial? Why not? They did Tim McVeigh, right? Didn't they move it to Denver, the Oklahoma City?
Yes, they did.
Why
and
would
the
they not
go with them?
Why would they not, in this case, be as cautious as possible and move it? You know, I think the suggestion was to D.C., at least to Springfield or something. But apparently, at least as of so far, Judge O'Toole is not. Joan, thanks for the call, and we're glad you found us, too.
You know, Elizabeth just emailed about the media circus following these crimes and how could you possibly get a fair trial. But that was another interesting point among the jurors that were questioned so far, is that a lot of them were not following the so-called media circus. They were.
You find
they were
that to be credible?
Off. Well, yeah, I think you get overload. I mean, you know, we are in the media, but I think to the average person, how much can you read? How many stories can you read about the terrible trials of the people that were injured in the marathon? You know what I mean? It's like,
how many people in Greater Boston do you think don't know who Martin Richard is, even if they weren't following this case closely?
I think lots of people don't know who Martin Richard is, to tell you the truth.
Well, let's assume they don't know his name. How many people do not know that little 8-year-old boy
they know that.
Who was standing on the side of the marathon? Well, if they know that, I am sorry, despite was it Tom before who sounded like a total good faith caller, I am sorry. It is really hard to have heard of this young man, his family, his sister who lost a leg, his mother who had eye issues afterwards,
yep.
And say, I can put all that out. And something Kevin Cullen says when he's explaining that people saying that they weren't overwhelmed by the media. It spoke a certain truth. Most ordinary people are too busy trying to get to and from the job, pay the bills, take care of the family obligations to be caught up in the frenzy. I'm not talking about being caught up in the frenzy. I'm talking about what I just described to you, a little piece of this sticking with you. One of these incredibly powerful people who lost a leg or maybe lost two who you see on television who you cannot believe have the strength they have. That all has an impact on most people.
I think a lot of us are very disengaged. I mean, I've been stunned over the years just covering trials of big murder cases that people seem to be sort of out of it a lot of times. I mean, that was kind of a joke, you know, that on certain juries, a sad joke in a way that, gee, these people have no idea what's going on.
Is there ever in Boston, other than the Charles, well, obviously it didn't go to trial because Charles Stewart killed himself, in murder cases, in the last 20 years, I hope I'm not going to embarrass myself, other than Charles Stewart in the last 30 years, has there been anything even close to approaching this in terms of media attention, even close? I would argue this dwarfed Charles Stewart, even though that was huge. Has anything come close?
Well, I think I go back to this case many times because it was a big deal in Boston. This is a long time ago. This is when I was first a reporter in Boston. The Deborah Smith case, the nurse that lived on Commonwealth Avenue that was raped and murdered because it was Commonwealth Avenue. She was a white nurse. There were two teenagers from Roxbury. And it's one of those things that gets at everybody's fear is that these kids just... They pushed a bunch of buzzers until someone buzzed them in, and they just randomly chose this woman's apartment. She was like 25 or 26 years old, and she was raped and murdered. That was a huge...
Okay. So we've named
story.
Three huge cases
but you had
in 30
a juror,
years.
You had a jury, and you know what they did? They found the young man guilty, but of second-degree murder, not of first-degree murder. So it's odd. As we all know, the jury acquitted O.J. Simpson.
Well, but that's a little bit of a separate case.
It's a separate case, but I think—
I would argue that the acquittal is absolute proof that they couldn't be fair and impartial. As you and every other observer has said, they didn't decide it based on the evidence. They decided it based on the horrible reputation of the police Los Angeles.
Yeah, they decided based on the fact that they did not, almost every witness get on the stand was a police officer or related, some law enforcement person, and they did not believe anything law enforcement said.
Let's go back to the calls. We'll go to Campbell in Dover. You're next on Boston Public Radio. Hi there, Campbell.
Hi, thank you so much. You guys are wonderful,
well,
and you help us stay on top of the world so beautifully. Thank you.
Well, you guys help us stay on top of the world, too. Thank you, Campbell. I mean that. Go ahead.
My point is I have just been called for jury duty, and I'm delighted to be called and look forward to serving, but I'm self-employed. I don't have an employer to pay me if I'm in jury duty, and I think that's a particularly important point as a part of your very important point that there needs to be fair compensation to people.
Yeah, it's really terrible. I mean, it's really terrible. If you're ever in a trial for 2 weeks or 3 weeks, I mean, there goes your mortgage payment.
Yeah, and three months would damn near put me out of business.
Well, 3 months of that of $50 a day is roughly $3,000. I mean, it's so true, and you're the perfect example, obviously, as self-employed. You know, putting that, Campbell, but over and above the financial pain that you'd suffer, could you judge fairly in this case?
I think I could.
Why?
I happened to be visiting a friend about a block away from the shootout one night, and I was with another friend whose house, literally the backyard, was shared with the backyard where the boat was, where they caught him.
Sure.
So I was kind of in the middle of this in an odd way, but I do think I could probably do it.
Sounds in your voice like you might be one of those people. Campbell, thank you much for the call. Want to take one more quick one?
One more quick one. Let's go to, that was Campbell. We'll go to Donovan in his car. Hi, Donovan.
Hello, Donovan.
Hey, how's it going?
Excellent.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Sure.
I'm actually concerned that I would be the guy that they would call because I'm not normally from around here.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I'm pretty, I don't like secondhand information. I just like the facts about situations. I can't watch regular news.
Yeah.
So it's pretty wild. And then also on top of that, I'm from Oklahoma to where they have the death penalty. And then I've studied to where they do not have death penalty in school. So it's like, I think I'd be like the ideal candidate, which really scares me if they ever call me for like Whitey Bulger or any of that stuff. Cause I don't know about any of this stuff. So it's pretty wild.
You know, Donovan, do you remember the Timothy McVeigh trial being moved? He, of course, was the so-called Oklahoma City bomber. Do you remember, were you in Oklahoma when that happened, when they moved it out of Oklahoma, the trial, or moved it out of Oklahoma City?
I recall that a little bit. And it's pretty wild because I worked in Oklahoma City for a while after that happened. I talked to people that had experiences with everything, but again, I didn't like watching the regular news. I love listening to NPR because of that reason, because they present more of the facts. But when it comes to Timothy McVeigh, I see it all on TV, and I think you guys have talked on your show about becoming numb to situations when you're not directly near it. Even in Oklahoma, I was in Tulsa, and I felt numb to the situation, even though I knew a little bit of what was going on. I didn't know. I only like to know the facts, basically. So
yeah.
Donovan, We're glad, and we're glad you ended up here. Thank you much for the call.
I think there's a lot of people who don't follow the news that closely, not because they're just disengaged, but because it's too much.
Yeah, but one last time, I don't think this is only about following the news, which would be in a typical case. The emotion of this, the tentacles of the emotional impact of this, when you saw survivors on TV and read about them every day for months and still do, and are going to see them and have seen them again.
What I'm arguing is people don't read about survivors every day. They just don't. They can't keep doing it.
And they don't
it.
See them on television.
They might, and but they I think it's too hard to listen. I mean, the stories are heartrending.
I'm not saying go out of your way. I'm just saying you can't live, in my opinion, in this community and not be affected by this. But obviously the judge feels otherwise. We shall see.
Okay, coming up, we're going to switch gears entirely. Here we've got musician Dwight Richard joins us. He is performing in Cambridge at the Beat Hotel tomorrow night. We're going to hear him play live in Studio 3 next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy, and she is Marjorie Egan. Here with us in Studio 3 for a live music performance is jazz and blues musician Dwight Richard. He'll be performing at the Beat Hotel tomorrow night. We're also joined by Bruce Ferrara. He's the music director of the Beat Hotel in Harvard Square and the Beehive in the South End. Dwight, Bruce, great to see you both. How are you?
Good to see you guys again.
Good to see you.
Thank you very much for coming in. We're going to hear a bit more about the Beat Hotel and the Beehive, which I actually visited. It's a fantastic place in the South End.
Oh, you did?
Yeah,
I've been
great.
Looking for you.
It's great. I was
so
there.
So have I, actually.
I was hoping you were going to come in.
I was there, and you eat your dinner or have a drink right next to listening to music. It's an unbelievable thing. But first, I'm going to talk to Dwight, because you are starring at the Beat Hotel on Saturday night, which is tomorrow night, correct?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and you're from New Jersey.
I am.
Yeah, and tell us, you have sort of a fascinating history about how you got to be a wonderful performer that's going to be songs featured on TV and everything else.
Oh, well, that's nice of you to say. I grew up down in Jersey, right near Asbury Park.
Oh, stop right there.
Oh,
Asbury Park.
The whole thing.
There is a Springsteen
Don't
connection
get off
in
on
the
this.
Family.
Don't
is
get off not? On
well, let's
this.
Get this out of the way. There okay, is a Springsteen right. connection, right? Your uncle or your something?
Yeah, I mean, he played. Yeah, he did. My uncle played with Bruce when Bruce was coming up at the jam sessions and stuff. And then, you know, after that, Bruce went out into the world.
But, okay, I've gotten over it now. You can continue. I'm sorry.
Because as soon as
you
say Asbury Park, right away everybody has to get that.
It's true.
Question.
It's true.
Okay.
And it's all those bars. We all came up, you know, playing the same bars.
Okay. Well, let's get away from Bruce Springsteen and get back to you. So tell us about you and your grandfather and playing the drums and all that.
Okay. For those who don't know, Asbury is right next to Red Bank, New Jersey, which is where Count Basie's from originally, before he became famous in, you know, Kansas City. So if you add that in, and then you take my grandfather's angle, who had a touring big band in the 40s, pretty much up and down tri-state area, nothing, you know, crazy. That was a big tradition for me, as well as whatever, you know, a 12-year-old kid's got, rock and rap and everything else.
Wait a minute. He had a touring big band.
He did.
So this, we're talking like 30, 40 people in the band.
I think it was around 20.
Wow.
But yeah, and they played a bunch. And he also was an inventor. And I don't quote me on this. I think he invented the transistor radio ring.
No.
Because that's my mom, the first one that had a patent.
What's that?
There was a little speaker in the ring. He was always wiring circuits and speakers for me as a kid and you know, to see how mercury would complete a circuit and all this stuff.
Wow.
So he made a ring that had a speaker on it. I think he got a patent for a transistor radio ring.
So you're not long for the big band era. I mean, I don't mean just the music, but when Marjorie asked you how big the band was, and she said 30 or 40, and you said 20, and 20 is only half, but 20 is huge.
It's big.
How great must that have been?
I never got to see him play, but that tradition, that music, and obviously I've seen all the Basie and Ellington videos and everything I can get my hands on, that tradition is lost today.
Yeah.
Sorry to interrupt.
Oh, Bruce, there you are. I'm sorry. We forgot about you for a second.
I want to hear more about the transistor ring and all that. But big bands are alive on Sundays Remember?
Oh, yeah. That's true.
We were setting you up, Bruce. It's okay.
We have fabulous big bands on Sundays.
Tell us.
Greg Hopkins, who's played in that era. You know, he was 9 years with Buddy Rich's big band, which means he has very thick skin, I think. But he's a really well-known arranger, composer, veteran big band. So he has a beautiful, you know, incredible big band. And then we have, you know, you guys remember the last time we were here with Brian Thomas and Alex Lee Clark?
Yeah. Of course. That's right.
So I've been every Sunday. I look for you guys and think I'm going to give you all these like free steaks. It's going to happen.
Don't embarrass us like that. What are you saying? You said a free steak?
Yeah, man.
You'll be saying this in the relatively near future.
So people dance to these big bands?
No.
No.
With some of the music, it's really hard to not dance.
Yep.
But because it's of our the way that we're set up, we don't really have room for dancing.
Okay. So why'd you book this guy?
Well, I met – when I first started doing music for the Beehive at the time, I was in the middle of the jazz scene. I know, you know, a lot of the jazz players, and I just wanted to find different types of music. So, I mean, if you needed a jazz gig, I could get you the best jazz gig, you know, in the world without a problem. But I asked a friend – I mean, it's a really great community, the music community around here. I asked a friend named Jeff Galindo, a fabulous trombone player, a force of nature. If you've ever seen him play, he's really beautiful. And I said, who do you know that would be a change of pace, someone that would be on the level that we're interested in, who's a, you know, can sing, singer-songwriter kind of person? And he said, you have to have Dwight Richer come.
Well, we get away from Dwight Richer's story. So we got as far as the grandfather with the transistor radio and the big band. But how'd that get to you?
I was so influenced by all those records and having that music around. But I also at the same time was into all the singer songwriter people and
like who?
I love Bob Dylan and Leonard Cohen and Hank Williams. But then I also like the soul stuff like Bobby Bland and. Obviously, Sam Cooke. Everybody loves Sam
Where's your
Cooke,
Jersey but, accent, by the way? I'm a Philly boy, and I can
water,
detect it.
If I
oh,
say
there
water.
It is.
There
Thank
it is.
You. That
Thank
is
you.
Fabulous.
There you go, everybody.
So you started playing in high school.
I did, yeah. I started out as a drummer, and they'd sneak me into the bar Bombay and the clubs down by the racetrack, and I'd play with all the – I played a lot of blues music. That's what I grew up playing, a lot of that. And I also played in shows, Pirates of Penzance and My Fair Lady. I played in the pit.
Really?
Oh, that is great.
Yeah, and I'd memorize the show. They'd give me the tape. Because I didn't read well enough. And I remember after the first gig, the conductor, she brought me over. She goes, you did a good job, kid, and we're going to get you back again. But she said, don't turn the drum music with the violins. They're not in the same place you are.
Hey, wait a minute. So if you don't read – do you read music now?
I read a little bit, but not
– So you're playing by ear.
I play a lot by ear.
Wow.
Yeah, you get
perfect pitch?
I've got good pitch. I wouldn't say it's perfect.
Pretty
I don't
good.
Know. Definitely not this morning.
Hey, I want to hear more about you, but I want to hear you play. Can you play something for
us? Sure.
What is it?
I'll play you a new tune. What's the name of it? I'm trying to think. It's coming to it's that new. I'd say it's called Come Back Home.
Okay.
And it's a love story about love gone wrong. Guy that lives near me. So, guy, that's all I'm going to say out there.
But, here he is, Dwight Richer.
Well, it's been going on a while. You keep coming back to me. I know right and wrong, but somehow I can't let things be. And no, love that I can see it. Love that I can see it, and forever together, wherever we roam, come back home. So hold me close and hold me tight. Stop the time and tragedy, 'cause you and I both know that it will be as it should be. And oh,
there's love that I can see. And oh, there's love that I can see, yeah. Forever together, wherever we roam, come back home. And oh, there's love that I can see. And oh, there's love that I can see, yeah. Forever together, wherever we roam, come back home. You know you come back home.
You know, Bruce, despite what people say, you actually know what you're doing, it appears. It's amazing.
I know. He's wonderful,
you are
isn't
great.
He?
That was really
yeah, you got a
beautiful,
a beautiful voice. So your new release is Radio Man. You're getting played all over the place with that. And you got this song. Now, I want to ask you if I would assume this matters a lot. This song, Something Special, off the last record, Drive Around Town, has just been picked up by Lifetime TV to be used in the show Missing in January. So how big a deal is that for your career?
It's just cool. Every little, it's like just like you guys do. You're all so busy all the time. Every little blip of thing, you're just honored to keep the momentum of going, because this is what I've always wanted to do. And it wasn't an instant thing. I worked construction, painted houses, and I was a knife salesman. And
what kind of knives did you sell?
Cutco knives. So
this is one of my kids sold Cutco knives. How'd you do?
I'm not.
She was horrible.
Good.
She was horrible.
Yeah. Okay, so. And then you can't solicit in New Jersey anymore, so I couldn't go door to door anymore. So I couldn't cut the pennies with, the scissors.
I don't know if I'd want to see a knife salesman show up at my front door.
I was a friendly knife salesman.
Oh, okay. What are Cutco knives, please? Is there something special?
Well, he's the salesman.
Yeah,
ask him.
Well, it's this knife with triple pan construction and laser sharpened edge.
Oh, listen
and,
to him. I'd buy one of those babies.
Never have to resharpen them, kind of deal?
Well, I mean, yeah. Every day lasts about 10 years. We have scissors that are collapsible that are very good. In the
we have scissors that are collapsible. Hey, Dwight, I know what Bruce is going to say. I'm going to ask him in a minute. I mean, my understanding, you lived in New York. Is that where you live? Now?
I lived in New York for 5 years. I lived in Boston for 5 years.
Then Vermont or something?
I live in Vermont.
That's
now.
Where you live now.
Yeah.
So what's compare the Boston music scene to Jersey, New York, to the rest of New England. What's the Boston music scene like?
The Boston music scene is amazing. And
how
and,
so?
And well, a couple reasons. If you're a new group, and you're in New York City, and this is I love New York as well. I'm not playing favorites, better or the worse. If you want to work on a sound of a band, a good way to do that is in front of people. See if they're moving, to see what their reaction is to the song. In Boston, you have a chance to get a residency somewhere. And there's so many different places to play in town. In the city, in New York, everyone's got an hour slot or 45-minute slot.
Yeah.
It's very hard to develop a sound of a band and to get a chance to stretch out. And that's a beautiful thing about Boston. Place like Atwood's, obviously the Beehive being and the Beat Hotel being way up there on the list. There's so many venues that will foster people and give people a chance. You know, and Bruce hired me just from Jeff mentioning me. I mean, I played a lot around Boston and a lot around the city, but I got a chance to work on the sound of another band which will be here on Friday, this tonight and tomorrow night, which is an organ trio, Hammond Organ. Guitar, I sing and play guitar and drums. So we have it was another thing that I wanted to develop along with the other balls that I had juggling. So
an organ trio, what kind of organ?
It's a Hammond organ.
It's not a huge organ.
It's like a chop church organ.
Wow.
And my friend Jeremy Parker plays the organ. My friend Benny Benson plays drums. And he runs bass lines with his hand and his feet. And so it's a very, very full sound.
That is cool.
You know, speaking of the Boston music, Brian O'Donovan, who spends time with us here from Celtic Sojourn, nobody sells this scene better than he does. But what's your take? We just heard Dwight's take on this. Why is Boston? It is hot right now, is it not?
Well, I think it's something I've been thinking about. We were just talking about it in the green room. I think people are starting to come back. I shouldn't say back, but I mean that there are more places to play. There are more places to work out, and I'm starting to hear of musicians from that are from New York that are starting to come up here. And the thing that Dwight was saying about having a place to play is very, very, very important, because it's you need to be in front of people. For some reason, it doesn't seem like music really happens. And that's something that I want to always keep in the forefront of my mind. And one of my goals at the Beat Hotel and the Beehive is to give people a chance to work on stuff. There's a lot of music that was created because they had a chance to play.
We're talking to Bruce Ferrara, the music director of the Beat Hotel in Harvard Square, the Beehive in the South End, and Dwight Richer is this phenomenal musician who's been kind enough to spend some time with us this morning. When your friend, what's the name of the guy who turned you on to Dwight?
Jeff Galindo.
After Jeff mentioned him, what happened? I mean, did you actually go hear Dwight? Did you
no.
go listen to him?
Well,
but you trusted this guy?
Yes. Yes.
You never heard Dwight play before you booked him?
That's right. And
hello.
You can do a lot, you know, online these days.
Well,
Jim, can't
no,
you?
No. Well, yeah, I mean, I audition everybody online pretty much. I mean, I go down to New York and hang out and meet a lot of people.
But you never heard him play?
No, but you have to know Jeff Galindo. I mean, when I first fell into the scene in Boston, it was Jeff Galindo. I saw him at the Regatta Bar once. This is a quick story. I was at the Regatta Bar. I was not in the scene at all, just getting into it. And I saw it was a medium-sized band play, and this guy got up and played the trombone. I said, "Who the heck is that?" I mean, he's this powerful guy. And when you meet him, he's just – music comes out of his toes. So with Jeff Galindo suggests someone's good, you know that they are.
Why are you laughing like that?
I mean, no guitar player wants to sit around and listen to guitar players. You want to listen to horn players.
Yeah.
You want to listen to Scott Aruda and Jeff Galindo and John Aruda and Mike Tucker and all these guys. Jeff's just this big burly. He's like the guy that had the like leopard skin, the 20s strongman guy. I love you, Jeff. If you're
hey, Dwight. So, Marjorie and I are lucky enough to do this in a studio. If we ever had to do this in a stadium with the same number of people who are kind enough to listen every day,
we would
probably need like to be resuscitated. So, studio versus live for you. Compare the experience. I mean, what's the
studio like we're sitting in today? Studio here, when people love what they're doing and do their jobs well, studio is amazing. It's like a hang, and then things can go different ways. And if I'm not articulate someday and can't come up with something, you guys will steer me somewhere. So there's not studio is great. Oh, studio recording?
Yeah,
studio?
That's what, yeah, I'm sorry.
Oh,
I mean.
Okay. I thought you meant the hang
no.
today. No, both are great in their own way. Studio, you get to sort of perfect things and flesh out an idea and make it, I don't want to say perfect, but you can develop it some. And you can layer other instrumentation on it, and you can try things and listen to the recording for a couple weeks and not like it, and then come back and put horns on or organ or viola or whatever you want. Live is the energy, and it's moving people, and it's trying to make a connection with people, because I just don't feel like there's a lot of time left. We only have a certain amount of time.
Yeah.
So I like when I get down to
time left in life.
Yeah, like I mean,
oh my God.
Oh, I'm not trying to get all. I know.
I'm like sweating when he's talking.
Well, it's not. You know, it's
we
not,
got minutes, Jim.
Well, you know something that we don't know, do you?
I don't mean no. I don't mean in a downer way.
There's a lot of music, is what they say.
Yeah, I just mean you want to just take advantage of what time you have and do it.
When you said before that in New York City they have 45-minute like slots that you can play in, why is that? Because they have a lot of people, or why rush people through?
Well, I mean, and I'm specifically sort of speaking more of the scene on the Lower East Side, which changes a lot all the time, but there's a lot of concentration of people. I mean,
okay.
Manhattan's not huge.
So they want to have like four or five different acts in a single night.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. Okay.
You know, since you probably never thought this, but since life is short and time is running, could you play another song for us, please, Dwight Richer? Because you never know what's going on. What are we hearing this time? Do you know the name of this one?
I do know this.
That's
one.
Good.
Yeah, I feel like I should play like a little bit of blues.
You should play whatever makes you happy. It'll make us happy.
Okay. Let's do this one. This one's called Trouble in Mind. Mm-hmm.
I got trouble in mind, I'm feeling blue. I won't be blue always, I know the sun's gonna shine on my back door someday. I'm gonna lay my head, oh yeah, on that lonesome railroad track, watch the 52 train ease my baby back. 'Cause I got trouble in mind, I'm feeling blue. I won't be blue always, I know the sun's gonna shine on my back door someday. I'm gonna lay my head on a lonesome railroad track. Oh yeah, I'm gonna get that 52 train coming to ease my baby back. Yeah, you know I'm gonna ease my baby back. Yeah, I'm gonna ease my baby back.
Dwight Richards, so tell us all, Bruce Ferrari, what's the logistical deal? People want to go see this guy, want to go see the big bands on site. How do they get in touch with you guys? What's the deal?
Well, Dwight's going to be playing tomorrow night at the Beehive, which is down at Tremont Street. And it's free. Just come on in. It's a really great, a lot of energy, good place to hear the music. Dwight's starting at 10.
Good food, too.
Good food
and good
too.
Drinks.
Oh, yeah. Don't forget, of course, good food and drinks, and don't forget that, everybody. Especially my boss might be listening. Mm-hmm. I say that, and then the Beat Hotel Saturday night. Two very different places. Two great opportunities to hear Dwight play. 10 o'clock.
What were you saying? Tonight.
Tonight at the BI.
Right. I thought you said tomorrow. Okay.
No, tonight at the Beehive, tomorrow night at the Beat Hotel.
Okay. Got it. Yeah.
And don't forget Big Band Sundays.
Big Band Sundays.
7 o'clock. And everybody else. I do 1,200 gigs a year between both places. So
wow.
I must be really
tired. You are a busy guy.
Well, it's
Dwight, when you leave town or when you're done Saturday night, how do we find you? I mean, what's if people are more interested in your music and you, where you're performing,
what's
your deal?
You have the documentary, too. That documentary, Where's the Music At? It's going to be next year. What's
the
deal with that?
Well, that,
the 10 unsigned artists?
That came out, and that was like, it did some independent theaters, and then it didn't really go anywhere after that.
But we can still see it.
You can see
it.
Yeah, I think
Where's
you can go on
at?
Their website.
Yes.
I'm pretty sure that they
How do we
can
find
do
you, though?
I'm around a bunch, and I'm touring a bunch. You can look up right now the project that I've been doing a bunch as well is called Dwight and Nicole. My other half of 10 years is a singer as well.
Nelson, is that her name?
Yeah, absolutely. I think some folks would remember her from different things.
Biggest smile the guy's had the whole time he's been with us. Oh,
I want you to know. She's so great. So we play a whole bunch, and I'm up and down the East Coast, sort of between Georgia and back. Just dwightandnicole.com, dwightrichardband.com. Other than that, I guess on the Facebook, although I'm not very good at it because nobody's interested in what kind of sandwich I ate today.
Yeah, I know. I don't have anything. Right,
unless
that,
it's prepared at one of Bruce's two places.
Where in Vermont are you?
Burlington.
Oh, Burlington. That's a great town.
Yeah.
Okay,
so will
you
play us out of this segment there?
I will.
What are we going to hear on the way out?
What should we do? BB's going to be 90 years old. I want to do a tune for him.
Great.
I've been working on one for him, and I hope it comes out. I might screw it up, but I'll give it a shot.
Okay, go ahead.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
It was a pleasure to meet you, Bruce. Great to see you again.
Thanks.
We'll see you again soon.
Thank you.
Come see my organ trio and see if Bruce
knew what he was doing, right?
Okay.
We love playing there. All right. Boy, I have to. I'm right on the spot here. Let's do it. Okay, this is for B. Just gotta get that first verse going. I thank you for every note you sing. Thank you for all the joy you bring. Thank you. Oh, thank you. Thank you, BB. Thank you.
Dwight Richard is a jazz and blues musician. Bruce Ferrara is the music director of the Beat Hotel in Harvard Square and the Beehive in the South End. The Dwight Richard Band will be performing at the Beat Hotel tomorrow night at 10 o'clock. Dwight and Bruce, thanks for being here.
Thank you. Thank you.
Up next, we're going to be joined by Callie Thank Crossley. She joins us every Friday. She's the host of Under the Radar. She's going to talk to us about the Oscars and the protests and a bunch of other stuff. Callie Crossley next on 89.7 WGBH.
There's just so much, much more that I could say.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan joining us in Studio 3. She does on Fridays as host of Under the Radar with Callie Crossley. So it must be Callie Crossley. Hi, Callie.
Hello. How are you, Jim? How
Excellent.
Are you, Marjorie?
Hello,
Thank you.
Callie Crossley. Thank you for joining us. As always, let's start with these protests. Big story today in Boston. People, a bunch of protesters blocked Interstate 93. A few of them put their hands into these 1,200-pound barrels, so they couldn't, the cops couldn't move them. What do you think of this? I mean, there's been two sides emerging on this, and where are you, Callie, on the protesters?
Well, I think we have to begin with the fact that any kind of protest is never comfortable. That's the point of it,
yeah.
And it's never going to be convenient. That also is the point of it. I just wish, in this instance, they didn't really say what their whole deal was until later. As I understand it from our colleagues here, they weren't very open in discussing their purpose with the press, which seems crazy to me, since the whole point of this, if you're to raise awareness, then you need to be in the moment saying why, what's going on, and making it clear that you have a purpose. I also would like to see a little action plan from them. Like, we're here because we know the larger issue. If you don't know, here's the larger issue, and here's the action plan for you to understand. There's a couple pieces of legislation that we're looking at in the State House that can directly begin to shape some of the policies we think are bad and systemic in these issues that have led to some of the problems. Here's what's happening over here in this state, or whatever. Just give me some specifics. That's all I want. I don't think I have been out front in saying I don't think everybody has to know all the strategy now, all the goals, all the whatever. I also agree that people should not confuse the tactics, which I don't know were executed so well here, with the goal. And I think that happened a lot. But so there I am. So I'm across the board here.
It didn't bother you, and this drove me crazy. Mm. It really annoyed me that they seem to be co-opting the Black Lives Matter thing. This reminds me of when
Why? Because they're a bunch of white people?
Exactly.
Yeah.
A bunch of white people. You know, we talked about this before in the context of Mississippi Burning.
Yes.
And the help, you know, that all these
the
black people need to
yes,
be rescued
movies.
By all these white people. This seemed to me to be this yet again, and it drives – I hate that kind of thing. Didn't bother you?
Well, first let me say, if I understand their statement – that they are working with Black Lives Matter. Now, if that's incorrect, then I take your point. But as I understand it, I'm not quite clear if they co-opted or if they were a part of. And so to that extent, you always want allies, and you want allies that people wouldn't expect. You want your allies to come across the board. So for me, the key is what you've just said. Was it a co-opting? I don't know, because I just couldn't fully appreciate that they didn't tell me what the hell they were doing till after this long statement came out hours later. So that upset me more than anything else. Okay, in the moment, this is the media we're dealing with now. Tell me what's happening and why. I may still be mad about it, but I want to know in the moment.
You know, Commissioner Evans was quoted. This is from a report on Channel 5. Bill Evans, who was just with us a couple of days ago. I'm willing to bet none of these kids know what it's like to be black in a community. None of them know what it's like to live in a city. I just hate the fact that they think they're speaking out and causing a bad name for some of the kids that have a legitimate reason, I assume a reason to be upset, at least in their minds. You know, I have great respect for Evans. Let me respond to this whole issue of who these people are. Each of us has been to demonstrations in our lives. If we judged the demonstration by how much we liked the people we were demonstrating with and by some of their tactics, my guess is there wouldn't be any demonstrations. I think the reaction – I mean, you're a perfect example, Marjorie, and correct me if I'm wrong. Yesterday, your attitude was sort of what Callie said. If there's inconvenience, there's inconvenience. That's where I was. Mm-hmm. That's the nature of getting attention and whatever. The more you learned about the individuals, you know, he's saying they're anarchists, Commissioner Evans, there are a bunch of kids who are involved in the Occupy, et cetera. Your interest in – you're losing – what was support yesterday is disappearing because you don't like the people who are doing the campaigning.
Here's the quote that put me over the edge. This was from the spokesperson, Shannon Leary, who said defending their actions is a necessary call for change. And she said, disruptions wake people up a little bit from their privilege and insulation. And the reason that annoyed me is there were a lot of people that were disrupted yesterday that weren't privileged and weren't insulated from anything. I mean, how the hell does she know who was stuck in that traffic?
Well, when she speaks of, I'm not defending her, but when she's speaking about privilege, she's talking about the larger, writ large privilege, in which case pretty much a lot of people are, except for folks like Tamir Rice, who gets gunned down in 4 seconds. The little boy in Cleveland. So we can talk about that. That's a bigger conversation. So I would disagree with that point and say the point is correct. However, I want a teaching moment. If you're going teach me the moment, you got my attention. It's supposed to be uncomfortable. I may not agree with your tactic, but now that you have, don't miss the opportunity.
By the way, it's worth, the interesting thing is this is exactly what Callie's saying now is exactly what the mayor and the police commissioner were saying about the demonstrations that happened closer to what happened in Staten Island and Ferguson, saying, we want to sit down. We want to know what's the agenda. What is it there for
us to talk about? I disagree with both of you on that, because I think it's not their problem. I mean, this is where I am with the protesters. They don't have to come up with the policy. That's what you have the politicians for. They're supposed to be the policy want people. Same thing with Occupy. What was their policy?
Okay,
their thing was awareness. These people want...
Yeah. But there's something between awareness and policy.
Yeah.
Okay? There is a moment in between there to demonstrate to other people who, for example, may question, what are you talking about? I don't have any privilege. Or what are you talking about? Why are you doing this? Show me what the issue is you're out here.
The issue is unarmed young black men.
I know, but if you're protesting, it has to be something that people can take away who will never be in the park where Tamir Rice was shot down, or will never be where Michael Ferguson was, or will never be where Eric Garner is. You have to bring it back to – that's how you get and maintain allies. It's not the sole purpose of the protest to get and maintain allies. Don't misunderstand me. But it is if you're going to have a dramatic moment in which you have everybody's attention. Boy, you raise some awareness. I want you to work it so that at the end you walk away saying, I'm mad at them, but boy, they were talking about X, Y, Z. I agree with you. They don't have to come up with the policy, but they got to be leading towards something.
Can I end this part of the discussion with Kelly with this? I admitted yesterday, I'm not sure you did, that I was a total hypocrite, meaning I supported what they were doing unless I were driving on 93.
One of our colleagues
shall remain unnamed because I'm not sure that this was on the record, who we get along with wonderfully well, told our boss that he was screaming at the radio listening to you and me yesterday, saying they don't live on the South Shore. Mm. They don't live south of Boston. They didn't have to go through this. It's easy to support the cause because you didn't have to suffer the inconvenience.
It's also possible to be totally mad about being there in traffic.
I totally agree with the cause. So do I. And that's where I would have been, by the way.
Exactly.
Okay, let's move on to something that also has a bit of controversy around it. Yesterday morning at 8:30, the Academy Award nominations came out, and according to the Boston Globes, I assume these statistics are right, in the 20 top acting awards, 5 leading men and women, 5 supporting men and women. It has not happened since 1998, since it has been an all-white field. People are up in arms. Is it intentional? Is it unintentional? Is it a statement of the reality of, what is it, 93% of the people in the academy are males, 70-something are white? What was your reaction to this, Kelly Cross? Oh, I got it wrong? Backwards? What is it?
I think it's backwards. 93% white, 76% male.
My apologies. What's your reaction?
My reaction is that it is not just because you act in a movie, you're not guaranteed a nomination. So I don't want anybody saying, well, who thinks that there should be guaranteed a nomination? That's what nobody is saying that. But when there are Oscar-worthy nominations, I realize that's in the eye of the beholder, but by other measures, not mine, you know, by Golden Globes, by other awards who have noted that David Oyelowo's performance as King in Selma, Ava DuVernay's performance as a director were Oscar-worthy, were nomination-worthy, and it doesn't happen, then it makes you look and say, okay, now what's going on here?
So what is
and
going on here?
I think a lot of what the Academy voting is who you know and who you like. Don't misunderstand. But having been through the Academy Award process and not won, being nominated and not won, I didn't realize.
You would tell us you were nominated?
Yes, for Eyes on the Prize.
Oh, Eyes on the Prize,
yes.
Of course.
So what I'm saying is it's extremely political. You don't realize that until you're in it. So I recall at the time thinking, wow, we're a little production company. We don't have time to be putting ads in saying vote here, vote there. But a lot of that is driven in that way by the big studios. Having said that, Joseph Califano, who's a former domestic advisor to Lyndon Johnson, unhappy with the portrayal of Lyndon Johnson, at the end of his critique of that of the portrayal, said, "Don't vote for this film." And he said it and sent out his note on the day that the nominations were happening. If you don't think that didn't have some impact,
but
it was
nominated for Best Film. It was one of the 8 films nominated for Best Film. It just didn't
get.
But
I'm saying, that had an impact.
Hold
I'm
on
just
for
saying.
A second. Yeah. Did you get to go to the Academy Awards?
Yes, of course.
Oh, well, give us a little.
Oh, that's the end of this discussion.
Did you get one of those grab bags full of great stuff?
No, I didn't get the grab bags full of great stuff. But you get all the other bennies and whatever. Of course, I went. It was lovely. It
really?
Was great.
What'd you wear?
Yeah, but I was in the leading trend of people renting dresses at the time. But at that time, not everybody did it. But now I did it.
You did?
And, yes,
I rented
the dress.
A dress?
In.
Yeah. Designer dress?
Yeah.
By whom?
I can't remember who it was.
Okay,
hi.
Can we get back to the subject at hand? I'm sorry to interrupt, Margaret.
But that's
here.
Very exciting. I mean, how many people get to go to the Academy Awards?
Not many. It was excellent.
So you could see all the stars.
Right. But I'm
Did
telling you,
have
you it's political. Yeah.
There, so you could really
check
it
out. No, because I had a good seat. Hello.
So when you say it's political, let me tell you where my analysis of this would have been, which is exactly in the opposite direction. What is it? 93%? What is it again?
Yeah.
93% white, 76% male.
Yeah, but there's no question historically that this is, to say the least, a liberal leaning academy.
Well, no, that's
I would have
right.
argued prior to yesterday morning at 8:30 that even if Oyelowo and the director were not amongst the 5 best actors and directors, they were probably going to get nominated anyway because these are such guilt-tripped, and I'm not saying they weren't. I saw the movie and loved it, that they are such guilt-tripped, white, elite, left-leaning people that they'd nominate them anyway.
Except
so how do you explain that?
So how you explain it, I just went back to the political, is that there are certain large studios that really put out a lot for certain folks, like the Michael Keaton. I'm not saying his performance wasn't good. By the way, everybody, I'm not talking about anybody's performance and not having the right to be nominated. I don't see anybody in the categories where you might go, eh. So all things being equal, then it comes down to where are the political pressures and who do you like? That's how it usually happens. And that's what happened. So she is a young woman this is her 3rd film. She made a film, by the way, for $20 million when all those other big directors said they couldn't make it. So on that alone, she should have gotten a nomination.
And she's so impressive. I mean, we saw her when they came to Boston.
I mean, it's crazy.
She was very impressive when they had that full page thing about her in the New York Times.
And David Oyelowo is a Brit. He's affecting a southern accent of a black man and a history that he, knew something
of. Well, Brit
of,
or not, he was fabulous.
You know what
fabulous.
I thought was an interesting theory from Jessica Goldstein, who wrote a piece about this for Think Progress, I think that's where she wrote it. Anyway, she was saying how 12 Years a Slave, which won 3 Oscars last year, that was way back when.
Yeah.
And maybe there was some upsetness because when you saw Selma, all you could think of
was
Ferguson.
Right.
And right now.
That's
and maybe
right.
it's one thing to talk about, how terrible we were to those
Good
slaves
point.
Went back when. And now we're still terrible to African Americans in 2014, 2015. Maybe this made some people uneasy.
It may have, but I think it's a shame because it didn't have to be. This was not a question of some giving people nominations because you thought it was the right thing to do, to your point about left-leaning or whatever. These were Oscar-nominated, Oscar-worthy performances and direction, and people chose otherwise. So, Now we have, I think it's a bad, I think when they look at the whole thing, it's not a good thing.
Speaking of the beautiful people, which is what it is at these Academy Awards, which is one of the reasons some of us watch, very quickly, because food topics with you and me at least, and occasionally Marjorie's involvement. There was a story that has like 16 million comments already about how this. I don't even want to talk about this. It's some Chinese restaurant, it's a Korean restaurant in China where they give free food to good looking customers. And I have to say, most of the comments, I read some of the comments, they're appalled, they're this, they're whatever. And what I said to Marjorie before the show started, that's what they do in this country. If you go to a restaurant and it's a restaurant with a maitre d', tell me that the maitre d' doesn't intentionally seat either the well-known or good-looking people in as visible a spot as is humanly possible because it helps their business. How, assuming that's right, and I'm convinced I'm right, how is this any different? What's the big deal?
Well, in this instance, it's just good-looking and the Chinese restaurant in China. But here, power trips. So you could have some good-looking people, but if Mr. Powerful comes up and he looks like the fire plug, he's getting in.
Yeah, but right after the fire plug is the good-looking. All I'm saying is that's what restaurants – I assume there's some research out there
like a fire plug
that suggests if you see good-looking people when you enter a restaurant, you're going to feel better about the I'm assuming – all I'm saying is this is not an aberrational kind of thing.
Well, it's
power and looks matter.
Right, I mean, but I guess it's because they have a system that they've set up with – you know, they're going to base it on the beauty, however that's defined, of their faces, eyes, noses, and mouths.
They got plastic surgeons on site assessing how good looking they are. Can you imagine
no,
that?
No, I think that's kind of interesting, though. But it also means that's not a restaurant I'll be going to get a meal. So I don't worry about it.
By Renee Zellweger did not get a free meal the first time. The second time she went back after the head transplant,
really?
The whole meal was on the house.
I think he's making that.
Callie,
okay.
What are you doing Sunday night on Under the Radar
with
Callie
Well, one of the things that we're doing is we're talking about the new ink block Whole Foods, which took over the space of your former employer.
At the Boston Herald. It's unbelievable.
Well, yes. And we're talking – what I'm interested in is the partnership that got formed. They didn't wait till afterwards. They really sat down with some neighborhood associations, the Chinese Progressive Association among them, and talked about hiring people from the neighborhood. And the result was that there are a lot of people hired in the neighborhood.
Oh, good.
So it was the Chinese Progressive Association, another organization called IBA, and the workers. I'm sorry, I can't get the name of the other organization. But they did a lot of work along with the assistance of City Councilor Ayanna Pressley.
Yeah.
And so now when you go in your ink block Whole Foods, there are people from that neighborhood and persons of color and women working there. So.
You know, my former colleague Peter Guzman from the Herald had a great column talking about how the place where the pressmen used to go and they smelled pretty bad because they've been running the presses all night long to take their showers, and you'd walk on that stairway. It was a terrible stench. Now it's like the milk and honey spa of Whole Foods. So talk about a transformation. Callie, thank you very much for being with us.
Callie.
Thank you.
Up next, Emily Rooney joins us for Open Mic and her famous list of obsessions and observations and rants and raves. Stay tuned for that in 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
The power of pop.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Here with us in Studio 3, I forgot her name for 1 second, but luckily she had a nameplate that she got as a gift from two fine people, actually three fine people, actually a whole show, our show. It says the Honorable Emily Rooney, Commissioner of Common Sense. Commissioner, it's very good to see you. Thanks
Great
for
to
joining
see you.
Us.
Thanks for the honor.
Oh, thank you for coming in, Emily. As always, we're going to start with these protesters. You just got an email from David because we were talking about the protesters with Callie Crossley, too. He says, how can you equate uncomfortable, as in making people uncomfortable, with putting lives at risk as they were in the expressway? You three are out to lunch, he said, but I still love the show.
I bet you're not out to lunch.
No,
you were
not
appalled,
on this
right?
One. You know, I love good protests as much as the next guy. I actually liked the Occupy thing.
Me too.
They weren't
I loved
disruptive.
Them.
They weren't standing in the street. You know, it got on my nerves after a while because Dewey Square belongs to everybody. But, you know, they were respectful for the most part. I don't fully understand this. And by the way, you know, this whole thing about Black Lives Matter, I mean, the disturbing thing to me is that they need to be – I was just looking at the statistics, you know, Roxbury, Mattapan, Dorchester – that's where people are shooting each other the most, and black lives are killing other black lives. You know, this is where the awareness needs to be, not on I-93 in Milton. And I just wonder if some of this isn't a little bit displaced. I understand what the bigger message is, you know, about Ferguson, and you can't have, you know, police officers willy-nilly shooting people and everything. But most black lives are taken – not most. I don't know. I really don't know if that's true or not. But certainly most black lives in Boston are taken by other black people.
That, by the way, Commissioner Evans, when he was sitting right exactly where you're standing the other day, said almost the exact same thing. Mm-hmm. I'd like a little focus there. But by the way, stepping back from the protesters just for a minute on 93, I don't think people who are protesting what happened in either Cleveland or Ferguson or Staten Island are saying they're not concerned about that issue. They're focusing on a specific subset of violence, which is white cops or cops, let's put it that way.
But if Black Lives Matter, they need to look at the bigger issue, which is that far too many black people are involved in – but that's the bigger issue.
Yeah, but you know something, Emily, that drives me a little bit crazy because – you know, you've covered this. We've all covered this. There are everybody in the black community that I know that's a grown-up, paying attention adult that's working on this. They've got marches. They've got protests. They're working nonstop. They've got church groups. I mean, the idea that the black community is not trying to solve black-on-black crime is not so.
Stop it.
Well, they are really trying.
The
10-point
coalition
really,
has been working on this for 10 years.
There are people that devote their lives to this.
But, I mean, that's where it – so I'm just saying that
most of it
happens.
It would be fine
and
with
so
me.
The protests, in my mind, should be there.
What if they were on 93 blocking traffic yesterday morning and they had the broader message you're talking about? Would you have been okay with it?
No. Blocking traffic, you know, it's effective in that it calls attention to your cars, but it's really, really disruptive in a cruel way to a lot of people. It suggests that your cause is more important than my mission. And it's not
well,
right.
And by the way, I think there's that part has some truth. But I guess the flip side is it also suggests the only way you're going to pay attention to my cause is if I force you to pay attention to my cause by causing you inconvenience. And again, you weren't here yesterday.
No, I was at the Zarnaya trial.
I know, but we're going to get to that. I said yesterday on the air, and I said it again today, I am the ultimate hypocrite. I know that I'm supporting the action, and I know that if I was on 93, mm-hmm. I'd be screaming bloody murder
people
louder than anybody
else. People were getting out of
their
cars and doing just that.
We know.
And there was some concern that it might have backed up the Zarnaya trial because it didn't really get underway until 9:30, that some of the jurors, I mean, it didn't really matter. But that it could have delayed the start of the trial.
Well, people were talking about the fact that had he not already been there, he might have been in that massive traffic jam.
Can we move to the Sarnaev trial? Yeah. There are about four. I wasn't there. You were lucky enough to be there. I know there's a long list of things. I want to start with the one that is putting me most over the edge because it's closest to the thing that we've discussed ad nauseum. And don't worry, we're not going to scream about it. Well, I don't think we are today about the failure of there be able to be a radio microphone or a television camera in the studio. When I heard from, I think, a text or a tweet from you yesterday morning that the media, except for one sketch artist, were barred from the courtroom, what was the rationale for that?
There was no rationale and nothing given. And a lot of this jargon that they put out, I mean, we were all speculating on it. One person who spoke directly to Ginny Hurley, who's like the court, you know, whatever her name is, the magistrate
spokesperson,
said that because there were so many attorneys involved, that they were concerned that the sidebars would be overheard by the press. And by the way, they weren't really sidebars because you got to picture this. It was a giant conference table, maybe 20 feet long, maybe a little bit longer. Defense on one side, prosecution on the other. The juror took the front seat, and then the judge was sitting like catty corner to the juror. The judge did all the questioning. So if they did a sidebar, the sidebar was over the table, so they didn't get up and go somewhere. They were actually talking to each other across the table, so they were flipping a switch off so that anybody sitting in one of the other courtrooms listening in or watching this proceeding couldn't hear it. So that's why they did it that way, because not everybody could get up and go somewhere.
Which is what they usually do. They stand next to the judge on the side of the of his podium.
But was any defense given
of
this? And
no.
By the way, for those who are not sympathetic to media access, what were you – and I know it's not called the overflow. Wherever you were able to watch this – what were you not able to see that you would have been able to see had you been in the courtroom?
Well, you're watching one camera as opposed to what your eyeballs can see. You could look all around, you know, a courtroom. And by the way,
it's terrible.
I'm doing a post for WGBH.org. I say the camera was bought at Toys R Us. It was this amateur, tiny little camera that was completely blurry to the point where I went up to get a closer look, even though it was a big screen TV. You couldn't even see what the heck was on the screen. Somebody said, "Hey, Emily, is Jars Arnaev wearing a tie?" I said, "I can't tell." Now, what kind of a television screen is that?
It's terrible. The overflow courtroom is terrible. I was there earlier when he was in there for different corporate
and series. The audio kept going in and out, yeah. In and out. It was just bush league.
Wasn't there 7 minutes of there was seven questioning minutes of, where everything was dead?
And we were saying somebody who's a regular court attendee kept popping up and saying to the there's a monitor in our room, you know, a court monitor, saying you have to stop the proceedings because this is supposed to be public, and you can't be carrying on without anybody in the public. Right now, we're the only public there is seeing what's going on.
You know, people don't get upset about this, I guess, because I don't know why they don't.
I don't either.
I mean, we in the media do, obviously, because we're blocked from these things. But the increasing, which I see, is dramatically increasing public secrecy.
Yeah.
I mean, there are specific rules about closed meetings and open meetings, whether it's the Board of Selectmen or the City Council or a trial. And it seems as though they're breaking the rules all the time with no explanation and just kind of say, hey, you don't like it? Too bad.
Yeah, don't people want to see this? I have to say, even what I did get to see was riveting. You know, Zarin and I have stood up a couple times. He's taller and thinner than I expected him to be, and a lot homelier, by the way, for all those groupies out there who think they've got, you know, something going there. he's not good looking.
For the would-be,
if he ever was, he's not anymore.
Well, you know something else that drives me crazy? And I don't mean to cast aspersions on these artists, but there's one picture in the Globe today when he's got kind of a pointed nose.
Yeah.
I just saw something in NECN where he's got kind of a bulbous nose. I mean, can't they even get the
it's
noses
pointed.
Right?
It's pointed.
It's pointed.
Yeah.
But we had a bulbous nose on your station, Jim.
Let me tell you, though, is equally upsetting to me, and maybe this is the point place you're going, is the fact that Congress doesn't do anything on our pet issue, which is cameras and radio transmissions, or at least recording, and this media blockage that you described yesterday. What's equally important, upsetting to me, if not more, is most of the public doesn't care. And it's either because they're angry at the media in general, and all the media doesn't care for. This is a trial. This guy is being tried in your name, the United States of America.
Can I really discourage you?
Yeah, yes. Go ahead.
The jurors weren't even paying attention to what happened, except for right in the aftermath of the bombing. They all admitted it. Oh, you know, you can take the media with a grain of salt, and I don't pay attention to what the media says, and I don't believe everything. Really? So they didn't care until the shelter-in-place thing was, you know, they watched then. But as soon as that was it. It didn't affect them. It was they don't care.
So let's get more depressed. How was the judge's performance? Voir dire is the questioning of jurors. In federal court, it's done by the judge, not the lawyers.
Terrible.
He's what do you mean terrible?
He was shockingly awful. This has nothing to with his George O'Toole, nothing to do with his judiciary contact, you know,
ability.
This is how he asked the questions of the potential jurors. He was horrible. He was bumbling. He was inconsistent. He threw legalese in there. He didn't ask the same questions consistently of each person. He started out doing a 20-minute interview with the first four people. Obviously, that was way too long for each person. Then by the end, he was giving some of them 40 seconds. I mean, he didn't have a plan, and he did all the questions. And then the defense occasionally got upset. That's the stuff they didn't want us to hear. We heard a little of it, by the way. But they'd say, why didn't you ask him this? Why didn't you ask him that? And then you'd hear his response to why he didn't do that. But he wasn't focused. I mean, I thought they should have had a journalist do this.
You know, were there any victims there?
No.
Okay.
There was nobody there, Marjorie.
Okay.
Including the media. Nobody.
Okay.
Wait, I'm shocked. There were no survivors, no victims there?
They certainly weren't allowed in the courtroom. And only the media was allowed in the two rooms we were in. We had to keep showing our IDs.
So wait a second. That's even worse.
Or maybe they were in a room I don't know anything about, but I didn't see any evidence of anybody.
Well, they've
and I
got
was in and out the
another secret plan about how they're going to deal with I should call them survivors. I shouldn't call them victims. Survivors of this bomb.
They probably have another courtroom they're going to put.
Well,
them.
I hope they
but we can't find that out either.
Yeah.
I mean, I know, it is just incredible.
Well, we couldn't find out whether they dismissed any or all of the jurors. There was that original piece of information that 124 of 1,350 had been let go. But was that from Group A? Probably from Group A. What's going to happen with Group B, C, and D? We don't know. Yes. Yesterday, you couldn't tell. I mean, you could tell some of the people were obviously not going to be seated on the jury, but you never heard the word dismissed. So you didn't know in the end.
Okay, so Emily Rooney says during the questioning, really discouraging was the fact that a number of the jurors had no idea what was going on. Let's talk about something which they all know something about. Marjorie. Last weekend, did you get to go to the playoff game with the Patriots?
I did not, Jim.
Neither did I.
She didn't even know there was
Excuse
one.
Me.
There was
Excuse
one.
Me, Emily. I'm not done yet.
She didn't know.
There's a game Sunday night. Are you going to the game Sunday night?
I am not, no.
No, neither am I. I don't have a ticket. Now, Emily, let's get to you. Did you happen to go last week?
I did happen to.
And is there a possibility you're
There's
going Sunday night?
There's a good
Sunday
possibility.
Night? Now, what is it that separates you from us. We have nobody to talk to. We have no tickets. No one's offering us anything. You went last week and you're likely to go on Sunday. What's that about?
An invitation.
From whom?
Oh, I'm not saying.
She's got friends in high places. Yeah. Going to see Mr. Kraft?
An invitation.
Look at the nerve. I've never seen her turn red.
You know what?
Or
I'm not
look
red.
Nervous.
I believe that she is inside as well.
I have
is
a couple
not?
Of invitations. Yeah.
She's always
inside.
Like a luxury
you
box.
You believe?
Kind of.
She's not going to be
think
like
I'm going to sit outside?
One of those poor freezing people. I remember my poor sister went to a game a few
last
years
week
ago.
Last week was brutal.
Where the beer froze. Yeah. It was so damn cold.
Yeah, it was
that
brutal
stadium.
Last weekend. Too.
Can I tell you what's
Emily
unbelievable?
Will not be
dealing. Yeah, when you're in the media, most people who are not in the media think, well, yeah, tickets to everything.
Yeah.
We, about 10 years ago, when the Sox were in the playoffs, I think in 2004, we were so depressed that we were the only people in the media we knew who were not going to any of the games that we begged on the air. I'm sure, of course, you did. Do you
tickets.
Remember?
Yes, we did. We got some, didn't we?
Yes, we did.
Yes, we did. It was
really?
Then
head
did you go?
Of yeah, yeah. Of course we did. Then head, but of course they were seats on the right. They were great seats. Bob Sheridan, who was then head of SBLI, was kind enough to call us up and say, "I'm going to give you two seats," because he felt bad for us. The only problem with the seats is I was of rather large size at that time.
That was before you shrunk,
and I could not get out of my seat like in the seventh inning. Yeah. And Marjorie was suggesting. Next time we go, we should bring one of those spray cans of olive oil to accomplish
Pam.
The goal. In any case, okay, so Emily on Monday will give her report on the Patriots game because we will not be there. Now, Emily, the what is she again? She's the commissioner of common sense.
She's the commissioner.
Is here for this particular exchange. Emily Rooney.
Incomprehensible.
It's out of control.
How about common sense?
Doesn't matter.
Why not?
This is the kind of thing that drives people crazy.
It's your right.
Doesn't matter. I have absolutely no interest.
She has absolutely no interest. Commissioner, take it away. Emily's list, is it thematic?
All right. So you know how people say you should never say never?
Sure.
This is my list of nevers.
Oh, perfect. So it is thematic. Let's go.
These are a list of things that are never going to happen to me that have recently happened to other people.
Oh, okay. Great.
Okay. Number one, I'm not going to be arrested stopping traffic on I-93.
Well, we know. Right. Or that's put obvious. Your arm in a 1,200-pound barrel. Yes.
Marjorie, I think you're going to agree with me on never number two. I am not going to discover 1 hour before I give birth that I'm pregnant. That's that
Wait,
woman
I
last
missed
week.
This. What
last
happened?
Week, you were on vacation.
What happened?
Oh, and it's very common. Let me tell you something. Let me tell you something.
Yeah.
To the crowd called DUMB.
Yeah.
It is not very common. That makes me mad. And the medical, somebody from the medical, oh, it's very common. No.
What are you saying? A medical person
it
said it's very common?
Somebody did. Yeah.
You would not notice this thing the size of 17
notice,
bowling balls.
There's a couple other things that go along with being pregnant.
Yeah, that's a very good point, Emily.
All right. I am not going to fall through thin ice playing hockey.
No.
Now, I might fall through thin ice, but not playing hockey. I love running out on lakes and rivers.
That's
and stuff.
Not true. Before the ice is thick enough to do.
Sure.
Why do you love running out on lakes
I don't know.
And
I like,
rivers
I like,
where the
I
ice?
I like ice. No, I don't want to. I don't
you
intentionally
want to
go on thin
not...
ice. But it, I said maybe it could happen, but not playing hockey.
Okay.
Good.
I am not going to be called out for sending a dumb, biased, or racist tweet.
Yeah.
Like the Boston.com guy did.
Oh, my goodness.
What's that going to happen?
Yeah, poor Boston.
First of all, I don't tweet enough.
Wait, is this
the Boston.com?
This is the latest about Boehner you're talking about?
Yeah.
The guy was fired.
He got fired, I know.
Yeah.
You see what he tweeted out, which was fairly clever?
Oh, the under the bus. We
the photograph of under the bus.
He got thrown out.
Are you talking about Boston.com?
A little bit,
Do you think he should have been fired?
No.
I ordinarily don't think people like that should be fired. The problem is there have been a number of growing problems.
Maybe there were some other people who should have been fired.
Okay,
maybe.
But we shouldn't drive everybody out of town on a rail person.
Oh,
so
that's
you
right,
think
he
should have been given a second chance?
Yeah, yeah.
Give
him
a second
chance.
I would
have given
him a second chance.
Me too. Give him a second chance.
Okay, next.
I'm never going to be excommunicated.
Because you're not communicated to begin with?
There's a Mormon who's about to be excommunicated for being in support of same-sex marriage.
Yes,
I
read about him.
I know.
We should have asked Alex about him, Mr. Joseph Smith. We failed to do that. We'll do it next week. Go ahead.
All right. Obviously, I'm never going to win a Golden Globe. It's disappointing, but
you don't know that.
Also, I'm never going to be up for parole. And that woman who...
Which woman?
The woman who killed her 3-year-old.
Oh,
yeah. Should she get parole?
Well, she's been in jail for 25 years,
hasn't
she?
Yeah, what do you think? Killed the 3-year-old.
Which is awful. I have not read the case closely enough, so I cannot render an opinion. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I don't know.
But there are situations where 25 years is
enough. You
ever
been arrested?
Yeah.
For what kind of things?
Carrying dope on an airplane.
Is that? Oh, that's so great.
Oh, wait a minute.
She didn't even pause.
No. Wait a minute. You give us the
Federal
details.
Agent.
you know, stopped me when I got to the air. I was on my way to Europe, and I had two joints in a backpack. Oh, it was so dramatic. You know, I get pulled off, blah, blah, blah. And it was in a little jewelry box or something, which they'd obviously gone through.
Did you know you had two joints?
Yes. What do you mean?
How old were you?
I put them there.
How old were you?
I don't know. I was in college.
Did they have the dog smell sniffing?
I don't know how they did it. Anyway.
Wow.
So, but I was giving them lip. I was saying, oh, yeah, they'd been two diamond earrings. I wouldn't have gotten them back. But anyway, they were. It all.
They love
out.
When you do that.
They
by
arrested
the way.
You.
Really
did they
do.
Bring you to the police station?
Oh yeah, they brought me to some federal. I don't know what it was.
And what happened?
They said they let me go, and they said, and you can get two more down on 34th and G or something like that.
That's pretty good. Yeah, that's
wow.
a pretty good line.
All okay. right, you love all this stuff.
Yeah,
don't
we
you?
Do. Actually, we do.
That's a great
all right,
story.
I'm not going to get stomped to death by an elephant.
No.
This is
a
fearless.
Well, you don't know that either.
A fearless animal lover from Tufts got stomped together.
Is that true?
Yes.
Well, that's horrible.
I know. All right, this is sad but true. I'm never going to make it to the top of Yosemite Wall.
How about those guys, by the way? Can you imagine 19 days, no equipment? I may get the numbers wrong.
I missed that.
Well, they hang. But one guy fell either 11 times in 7 days or 7 times in 11 days. And when he was asked about it yesterday, sort of that's what happens.
But you're on a rope at least.
You're on a rope. So what?
Then you got to start over.
It is on 19 days.
How do you sleep hanging from a rope?
That's what I said. You can't lie down.
You know, you're swaying in the breeze.
I don't know.
And finally,
they put you on a ledge, Chelsea says, and Chelsea
I'm
knows
never,
rock climbing.
Ever going to be selected as a Tsarnaev juror.
Yeah, that's probably true. So that was the committee. What are you again? You're the
commissioner
of common
sense. These are all common sense.
Emily Rooney, thank you.
Don't you think so?
But
they're
wouldn't it be fun to be a selected? Not fun is the wrong word, but fascinating to be selected as a Tsarnaev juror.
But it's not going
to
happen.
It would be absolutely fantastic. And you know, one of the things about it, if you do get selected, the problem is, of course, you lose all your money because you can't work.
And a lot of people were upset about that.
But you do have a very relaxed schedule. You can probably read several novels in the time.
You've got to get there pretty early.
You have to get there pretty early. That's true. And you have to find a place to park.
And it's also a pretty serious responsibility. Yeah.
It's
a little
stressful,
isn't it? It's
a pretty serious responsibility. But, you know, a lot of us think about times when you could, like, read things, be on your iPad, whatever you wanted to do.
Yeah.
You have time to do
that. I don't think that's the primary reason one wants to be on a jury.
Sitting there in the jury box, you can't be reading a book.
No, but there's a lot of downtime. There's a lot of
what are you doing tonight on Beat the Press?
Well,
people, I assume everybody knows, you are continuing to do Beat the Press on our Friday deal forever. Go ahead. What's going on?
So we are going to do the Boston.com thing. As just one. A couple other things. I'm looking at, you know, Al Jazeera America, which launched about 18 months ago with all this great fanfare, real serious news, you know, documentaries, which they have kept their promise to. However, nobody's watching.
Oh,
so we'll take
I watched the first week, and actually it was some pretty good stuff. It was pretty good, but it got a little tiresome.
Can you even get them in Boston?
Oh, yes.
That's part of the problem. It's hard for some cable systems.
Cambridge
don't carry
it.
And yeah. What a surprise.
But I'm bummed.
All right.
Thank
see you later.
You, Commissioner.
Emily
it's good to
Rooney,
see you.
Commissioner of Common Sense, joins us every Friday for open mic. And you can see her tonight at 7 o'clock on Beat the Press,
great.
Channel 2, WGBH TV. Coming up, it's our Friday news quiz, a cheese lovers edition. Keep your dial on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. It's time for our Friday news quiz. One of our two contestants is here. The other is just seconds away. Today we're getting a jump start on a holiday that I know you're all planning on celebrating. That, of course, would be National Cheese Lovers Day, which is Tuesday, January 20th. Here with us in Studio 3 to get us primed are two artisans, or one artisan so far, as part of the Massachusetts Cheese Guild. Giuseppe Argentieri will be with us in a couple minutes, but with us now is Barbara Hanley. She's of Shy Brothers Farm in Westport. Barbara, it's great to see you.
Thank you.
And you're bearing gifts, are you not?
I am.
Let's get right to that. What did you bring?
Well, I brought 1% of the cheese produced in Massachusetts. I brought one of the types. We make over 100 types of cheese in Massachusetts.
You do?
We do.
You're president of the cheese, Massachusetts Cheese
I'm
Guild?
El Jefe, yes.
You are, okay.
Yeah.
And 1%, what do we make here? I don't even have to go through the whole 100, but what do we make here?
Every kind of cheese that is made literally in the world
is
represented in Massachusetts.
Is that so?
Yeah. Wow, I didn't know that.
What'd you bring today?
I brought a cheese that we make at our farm called Clamage.
What is that?
It is a name we made up.
Oh, it is?
That's good. I like that.
Yeah, because we own it, which is nice.
Uh-huh.
And
do we need silverware?
I've got some.
Oh, you do? Okay.
This woman came with
we
a cheese board and everything here.
I have woodware.
But you get a farm down there in Westport with cows and everything.
We do. Our particular farm belongs to the Santos brothers. Third generation dairy farmers. They're fabulous. Two sets of twins, so they're four boys, and I'll arm each of you with your very own woodware, and ladies first.
While Marjorie is reviewing that, how'd you get involved in the cheese business?
My husband and I were, you like it?
I'll do the same.
I hope that's a good sound.
What's the answer? I know her. It's a very good sound.
It's so fresh.
It is fresh.
Okay, how'd you get involved, Barbara Hanley?
My husband and I were really involved with land conservation. I'm sorry you don't like it.
That is fabulous. Go ahead. I'm sorry. You were involved in what?
We were involved in land conservation. We were watching the farms in Westport. We went from 14 dairy farms down to 2 in the space of 5 years. So I had come from a background of helping people make money. I like to do that. And my husband and I decided that we would transfer my skills to the extent possible over to the farming community. So we partnered with the Santos brothers.
But did you know anything about the cheese business?
Nothing.
Or you just knew about business?
Nothing. I knew about business.
So how much you know about cheese making now?
Well, I know a lot more now.
You do?
We had no idea what we were getting into. And made pretty much every mistake in the book, which is a good way to learn.
And here's Giuseppe. He's coming in bearing gifts.
Giuseppe is here. Giuseppe, your last name is Argentieri. Is that how you say it?
Yes.
Come on over to the microphone. He's from Mozzarella House. Giuseppe, you know Barbara Hanley, of course, from Shaw Brothers. And it's good to see you. What's your deal? Mozzarella House, what is it? And by the way, you were not there at the beginning either, even though Barbara teamed up with a couple of sets of twins. You teamed up with a woman. Well, tell the story, if you would.
Yeah, the story is that I took over a small business. It used to be in Everett. It's now in Peabody. And I used to be a customer, a loyal customer, of this woman that used to make fresh mozzarella. So I liked the product so much, I wanted to be part of it. So she was near retirement, and I felt that there was an opportunity for me to get in the business. So I took over. And here I am, 5 years later.
And did I read somewhere that she was hoping that what she was hoping she could give it to her kids or some such thing? What, she didn't have kids or they weren't interested? Or what was the deal?
Well, she would have liked to give the business to her kids, but their kids were not interested.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
And her non-kid, you, were interested.
Yes.
So what's your, you were literally just a customer at this business and all of a sudden you fell in love with the product? Is that it?
Yes. And just didn't want to have the chance of not buying fresh mozzarella anymore.
Well, that's a great point because really, I mean, you're Italian, obviously.
Yes.
Oh, really?
I mean, was fresh mozzarella something you could get all the time at home before you came here?
Yeah, that's how I grew up in a small town in southern Italy, in Puglia.
Yep.
And we were used to just sourcing each ingredient to the single producer. So the mozzarella, for mozzarella, you will go to a single shop. They used to produce mozzarella, and it was done and consumed daily.
And how much different does it taste when it's fresh mozzarella as opposed to, like,
It's great.
Hanging
it's
around
just
for a while.
It's a whole different feeling.
Whole different feeling.
Yeah,
that's like this cheese we just had.
When I heard you guys were invited because of actually this important holiday, National Cheese Lovers Day, which is Tuesday, I am under the opinion, and maybe you'll disabuse me of this, Barbara, because you said of the growth in recent years, I assume with the diet obsession that and the fat that I know this thing you brought, there's low fat and there's medium fat and there's whatever. I would assume the cheese consumption is going down. Am I wrong?
You are actually not correct at all.
Really?
Yeah.
And why is that? It sort of flies in the face of.
Well, there are two kinds of cheese. There's commodity cheese, which is like Kraft singles and, you know,
love those
stuff
when I was growing
up.
You unwrap
them
and shove them in. Oh, man.
Yeah. And that industry is actually expanding remarkably. But the artisanal business, which is where Giuseppe and I are, is
exploding.
It is. It's a,
Why? Why do people think that's true?
Well, I think that people are obviously very diet conscious and health conscious. And I think people care about what they eat and care about how it tastes. If they're going to eat, they're going to eat well.
Yeah.
So they might not eat something that's really junky and go for something that's very good.
And just don't eat that much of it.
And just don't eat that
right?
much
and
of it.
We have whole nations that seem to eat massive amounts of cheese, and they do fine. You're from one of them.
Now, Giuseppe, will you think less of me? I love mozzarella, by the way. But will you think less of me if I tell you that I've squirted cheese whiz into my mouth from time to time when I was younger? Would you be upset with that or no?
Oh, no, we've all done that.
Okay, fine. I just wanted to be sure.
Well,
let's start.
And we're glad you're alive.
Well, actually, those are some of the finest moments of my life, Barbara. Let's start the quiz, and then we'll learn more about both of your businesses, how we can get the cheese, how we can get in touch with you, all those kind of things. Who do you want to ask a question of, Marjorie?
We'll do a boy girl, and then we'll do girl girl at the end.
Fine.
Okay?
So you're going to ask Giuseppe.
You, Giuseppe. You ready? Here
sure.
we go. This week, a familiar face hinted toward a presidential run in 2016. Take a listen.
Will reportedly address the Republican National Committee on Friday to talk about a possible third presidential run. And it is never a good sign when you have to start your speech with, hear me out! Just hear me out!
Okay. Do you know who's exploring a third possible presidential run?
Is it Mitt Romney?
It is Mitt Romney. That is correct.
And unlike some of those presidents of Italy who are hanging out with teenagers, Mitt Romney never, except for his own children, Giuseppe. I want you to know that. Now, Barbara, here's your chance to tie this baby up. Who is David Letterman? Let me say that again. Who is the great David Letterman talking about here?
You know what? This is serious. Is a member of a country club in Ohio. Funny, you don't look like a country club guy.
No, but anyway.
It turns out that at the country club, they have the bar and the grill where you go and get your Bloody Marys and your drinks and so forth.
Yes.
Turns out, this is serious, the bartender was plotting to poison. Yeah. And I thought, wait a minute. Isn't that that movie with Seth Rogen and James Franco?
I know.
Was that?
I think it is.
So the question is, I'm very confused. Who was the bartender at that country club allegedly plotting to poison, please?
Mr. Boner. Oh, I'm sorry. Banner.
Thank you. That Banner. Was Barbara Hanley who said that. Thank you very much. It is tied at 1-2-1. How do we find your mozzarella there, Giuseppe? If we want to go buy it, where do we go?
The best specialty shops around the area in Boston, Cambridge, metropolitan Boston area.
They all carry it?
Yes.
And do you have a website or something?
Yes, mozzarellahouse.com.
That's probably a good
mozzarella
website.
House. That's very basic.
I like that.
Right to the point.
And Barbara, what's your deal? How do we find this stuff?
ShyBrothersFarm.com is the website, but we're in Whole Foods and most of the specialty grocery stores in Massachusetts and New York and California and Florida. We're happy.
It would make me happy if I were you, too.
Yeah. She made money for other people, and now she's making money doing this. That's a wonderful thing.
It's beautiful,
thing.
It's delicious,
too. I should get your card after the show. I need to make some money.
Okay, round two. It is tied 1-1.
Okay, here we go, Giuseppe. Jimmy Fallon. This is Jimmy Fallon talking about Sunday's Golden Globe Awards.
And the film won the Golden Globe for Best Drama. That's great. It follows one guy's journey over the course of 12 years. Or as Mitt Romney calls that, running for president.
That's pretty good line.
Do you know the movie that won the Golden Globe Award for Best Picture?
12 Years a Slave?
Good guess.
That is an excellent guess.
Good guess over
that
the course of 12
wrong.
Years, but that's not right. You want to go for it, Barbara?
I was not listening.
Oh! Okay,
She was coming up with a business plan for the Shy Brothers.
It just won the Golden Globe for Best Picture.
I don't know.
You're an honest woman.
What's the answer?
Boyhood.
Exactly.
That's why it went over 12 years. They filmed this guy as he was younger and then as he got older.
So 12 years a movie.
That's very good.
Give her a quarter of a point for that clever answer.
Okay.
Now, Barbara, here. No, don't give her a quarter. But here, Barbara, here's your opportunity to take a huge 1-point lead over Giuseppe. Here is Jon Stewart. I can't believe we have no more Stephen Colbert clues.
We used to always have Stephen Colbert.
Ah, here's Joe. We have to wait. You know, he's not on the late, whatever it's called, till September 8th.
It's a long wait.
Okay, here's Jon Stewart weighing in on a big, big news story.
1.6 million in the streets. Are we sure they weren't on strike? Was that a strike? I mean, I don't blame them. I mean, a 12-hour work month, that'll push anyone.
Okay, what exactly is Jon Stewart talking about there, Barbara Hanley?
The march in Paris.
That is exactly correct, and it is now 2-1 after two rounds. Other than mozzarella, what's cheese that's atop your list of faves? Favorite cheeses there, Giuseppe? What do you love?
Well, our second bestseller after the mozzarella is the burrata, which is closely related to the mozzarella.
Mm-hmm.
And usually popular on different menus, not just Italian food menus.
You know, we met Barbara before you got in the room. Barbara, who has business background, knew nothing about cheese making until she joined the brothers that you talked about. Did you know anything about cheese making when you started loving Mozzarella House?
Not at all.
Isn't that a little weird? How old were you?
Well, it was just 5 years ago. So.
Is that really true? And do you consider yourself, I'm serious, you're like a master maker now or no?
No, I wouldn't consider myself a master maker because I just got into the technicalities of how it's made. I am not involved into daily production.
Uh-huh. So you're the boss, essentially, is that what you're saying?
Correct.
Thank you very much.
And was this your first business venture?
No, my second.
Your second business venture. So you had run a small business before and then you decided to venture into a second business. Do you run two now or just one?
Two.
You run two.
What's the other one?
Wow.
It's coffee distribution.
You're really quite the magnet, wow, aren't you? What kind of coffee distribution are you in?
It's an Italian roasting company, quite famous, that I distribute around the Boston area.
What you is do. It? What's it called?
It's Lavazza.
Oh, I've seen of course. That. Oh, absolutely. That's everywhere.
Yes.
Wow. Okay, Barbara, here's your opportunity. Did we ask you a question already? We did. Did you just ask him a question?
I did. It's Barbara's turn. Didn't I just ask you a question?
Who knows?
No, I didn't.
Okay, it's right. It's 2-1 at the end of two rounds.
Okay.
No, this is for Giuseppe. Go ahead.
Okay, I'm on the top of page 2, correct?
Yes.
Something ironic happened while President Obama was making a speech this week. Here's a clip.
Cyber threats pose an enormous challenge for our country. It's one of the most serious economic and national security challenges we face as a nation. Foreign governments, criminals, and hackers probe America's computer networks every single day.
Okay, while he was giving this talk on cybersecurity, something else was going on simultaneously. Do you know what it was?
I think so. I think the Twitter account got hacked.
That's exactly right.
ISIS hacked the Twitter and YouTube accounts of the United States military and United States Central Command, or CENTCOM.
Okay, now it's tied 2-2. Barbara, you can take the lead. But before we get to Barbara, Giuseppe, I don't want to make you feel bad because you're nice enough to come here. You're running two businesses. I don't know if you're aware. Do you see that right there? That look at the right. You know what that thing is, that white box? That is a box of cheese that was brought here by Barbara Hanley. I look at you. I don't see any mozzarella. I don't see any burrata. What's up? What is? Oh, Giuseppe, you sly dog, you. It appears he's got a bag under the table. Oh. He is reaching under there.
Barbara's got a cutting board.
Okay, while Giuseppe is doing his thing, I feel better about him already.
Okay,
while Giuseppe is doing this thing,
Barbara,
here's your question. You ready?
Yes.
Oh, my God, look at this woman. She's got a knife. She's got whatever. Two climbers became the first to free climb a major U.S. peak this week. Here's a news piece about this amazing accomplishment.
Champagne on the summit after a climb that many claimed couldn't be done. On day 19 of their epic climb, they reached the top together. Tommy's dad and his young son were delighted.
We're probably going to really encourage him to get a shower.
Okay, what rock, U.S. rock formation did these two amazing climbers conquer, Barbara?
I don't know.
You do not know. Do you know Giuseppe? Giuseppe's preparing the mozzarella and everything else. You know what rock formation they climbed?
I know it was a sheer face.
It was
sheer.
We don't get
times.
Any points for that. I'm sorry. How about it? What is it?
I know that. I can't remember the name. It was barehanded, though.
It was barehanded. You don't get any points for that either.
Okay.
It's El Capitan in Yosemite National Park. Give me the points. Tommy Caldwell and Kevin Jorgensen became the first ever to free climb it, which is incredible.
Yeah, can you imagine that?
No, I can't.
No, I can't.
So what's the score, judges? 2-2? 2-2 before we go to the bonus round. Before we go to the bonus round, you have something that looks a little bit like a honeydew melon, but I assume is cheese. Is that correct, Giuseppe? What
yes.
is that? What is that baby right
it's
there?
It's called Scamorza, and it's a dry-aged mozzarella.
That is one of the prettiest things I've ever seen. Now, can you walk and chew gum or cut mozzarella at the same time while we continue the quiz? I had a feeling you could.
Okay.
Now, here's the bonus round theme for the two of you. He brought napkins, too. Since the theme of today's quiz is cheese, I assume you're aware of that. That's why you're both here. We're going to ask you about Who Moved My Cheese, which, of course, is the best-selling book about workplace survival. This is the point where Marjorie tells you all these questions are really difficult, so don't be upset if you don't get them right. You want to say that?
Yes, that's right. I do, because people feel bad when they don't get them right. They're very hard, so don't feel bad. You ready?
So you're going to switch and you're
going to
ask Barbara?
I'm going to start with Barbara. It's going to be girl, girl now. Okay, Barbara. What is the title Who Moved My Cheese refers to? A, the worker's cheese that gets moved around in the office fridge. B, the cheese that gets moved around a mouse's maze. Or C, the big cheese who gets demoted and kicked out of his corner office?
All good questions.
B.
You
B.
are correct.
Wait, did you know that?
I did.
You did know that?
I did.
How about a ding, ding, ding? Thank you very much.
Did you read this book? Is that how you knew?
I must have.
Yeah.
It's been a while.
Okay, who moved the cheese?
I wouldn't brag about that. Now, before we get your opportunity to tie things up here, look at the smile on his face. He's pretty proud of his work. What are we getting the taste here?
I will start with the ricotta because it's the mildest of the four.
Okay, can we do that?
I love ricotta cheese.
Okay, fine. Now, Giuseppe, I'm going to ask you a question while you're opening the ricotta. Is that okay with you?
Sure.
There are many parodies of Who Moved My Cheese. Which of these is a real-life one? You got to focus on this. A, Who Moved My Jesus, using faith to survive the workplace. B, Who Moved My Soap, A CEO's Guide to Surviving Prison. Or C, Who Moved My Velveeta, The Who Moved My Cheese for Dummies. Is it A, B, or C? Is it the Jesus, the soap, or the Velveeta? Which is it?
I don't know the answer, but I'll go for B.
You are also
very
correct.
Good.
So after we eat the ricotta and whatever else, we'll have our final question, which will decide who goes home the cheese winner just days before National Cheese Lovers Day. What, Margaret?
I think you have to ask the last question.
Why? You can't read it?
I can't pronounce the name.
Okay, fine. I can. Now let's taste the ricotta, which is really why we're here. Go ahead. Thank you very much. Marjorie loves ricotta.
I do.
Okay, here's. Does she not? Does Barbara not get any because she's a competitor, or what's the deal here?
Correct.
We're friendly competitors.
Oh, my God.
Oh, once again.
Right.
Give me some.
You know, I love cheese, and I love to make lasagna. And let me tell you something. This
is
would
fabulous.
Make the most spectacular lasagna I've ever made in my entire life. Mm. This is really good. I'm so glad you guys came in here today. You know what often happens, and it's really upsetting?
No.
We have people that come in to talk about food, and we're reading about them, you know, what they make and all the trouble they go to, and then they come in with no food.
But wait a second. What was the name of the company, our colleagues, those two young guys who were making alcohol, and they felt we made them feel so bad that a week later they brought a case of liquor back? What was the name of that company?
I forgot.
Bully Boys, that's correct. They were fabulous. They were great guys, and the liquor was great.
Now, oh, my God, Giuseppe, that's wonderful.
Barbara, here's the deal.
Wonderful.
Here's how this works. Since it's tie, before we get back to the next round of cheese with Giuseppe, if you get this right, you win. If you get it wrong, he wins. That's the way it is. You got it? You understand the rules?
Good.
Okay, it's sort of like a, you know, winner takes all or loses all kind of thing. Barbara Ehrenreich reviewed Who Moved My Cheese for the New York Times in 2005. Which of the following did she say? A, it's the kind of book that lunges out at you from the airport bookstore and slaps you in the face. B, giving this book to workers is like telling them they have bad breath and handing them a bottle of Scope. Or C, a must-read, two thumbs way up. Now, again, take your time. You get this right. You have the pride of having won the Friday News Quiz on Boston Public Radio. You get it wrong. Giuseppe is the proud winner. What's the answer?
C.
I tell you, Barbara, you're a good person and an excellent businesswoman, but you lost. The answer is it's the kind of book that lunges out at you from the airport bookstore and slaps you in the face. Congratulations, Giuseppe.
Thank you.
You are the winner. You showed up late, you barely got here, and you won the thing. What are we eating now? We only have a minute left.
This is mozzarella, and it's shaped in a knot.
Oh, bring it over. Thank you.
Giuseppe, you should try mozzarella filled with clamage.
Oh, my God.
I will.
Really?
Yeah.
Do you do that, like a double whammy kind of deal?
He can do that, yeah.
That's
Marjorie,
wonderful.
Taste this. Yeah. You know, in all seriousness, you guys are both really talented, and the cheese is beautiful. Is there a website for your thing, did you say? What is it again?
It's mozzarellahouse.com.
Oh, you told us that. And what's the deal
for
you?
The most important website here is the Massachusetts Cheese Guild,
yeah.
mycheeseguild.org.
Now, could I join the Massachusetts Cheese Guild if I wanted to?
We have 150 members.
And what benefits would I get if I were to become a member?
You will be introduced to new cheeses early. We have member-only events where only you can come in and taste the cheese.
Do you know a guy by the name of Bobby Constantino who lives in around Quincy?
I know of him.
Bobby's a good friend of mine, was a close and great friend of Chet Curtis's. He had the honor in San Francisco several years ago of being inducted into the Cheese Hall of Fame. So let me tell you,
pretty
I travel
amazing.
In some pretty important circles.
Okay, Mr. Quipster, I'm amazed you didn't say this.
What's it? What's
we
it?
We have an emailer who said that the winner of this quiz, this is
the
from
big
Andrew.
Cheese?
Nope.
What?
The Cheese Whiz.
Oh, that's actually
Andrew,
great. Andrew, well
thank
done.
Thank you very much.
Giuseppe and Barbara,
it's
great
cute.
To meet you both.
Thank you.
Thank you both
fabulous.
Very much for coming in. Okay, thank you all for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. And please tune in on Monday when we're going to be doing All Revved Up with the Reverends Irene Monroe and Emmett Price and our TV expert Bob Thompson on Woody Allen's new television undertaking. We're also going to be talking about politics, which we do every single Saturday and Monday. Okay, do we give the websites already?
Yeah, we did.
I say just again, Giuseppe Argentieri of Mozzarella House, Barbara Hanley of Shy Brothers Farm in Westport. Thank you again. Our show is a production of WGBH Boston Public Radio. Our production team, Chelsea Murs, Will Roseup, Amanda McGowan, Catherine Whalen. Our engineer today is Alan Mannis. I'm Marjorie Egan.
I'm Jim Brian. Don't forget Tuesday, National Cheese Lovers
Day.
That's
right. Thank you so much for listening. Have a great weekend, and please tune in again on Monday. Bye.